Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of the Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
You need to know about fallout, what it is, how to detect it, and what to do to protect yourself against it. Everybody needs to know. Yes, this does mean you. Watch and listen. One day, these facts may save your life. What is this fallout, anyhow? These bits of matter can be dangerous. You can go out for very brief periods if you are well covered and keep the dust off your skin. Wear heavy boots or shoes and pants tucked in or tied around the bottom to keep dust out. If any dust gets on you, brush it off promptly. And when you have a chance, wash it off. That dust can burn your skin. But what happens if you do get exposed to a great deal of fallout? Internal damage may occur. When dust has been left on skin, there will be skin burns. When you have been near dust too long, there may be radiation sickness. Exposure can even cause death. If you have had considerable exposure, you will vomit and grow weak. But after a few hours, this sensation will pass, and by the next day, you may have had the last of it. Even if you have been exposed to excessive fallout, you may eat and drink just as you normally would, but don't force yourself. Keep an eye on your condition for the next few days. Watch especially for these developments in the 2 weeks following exposure. Return of nausea. Sore throat. Bruise spots developing without any known reason. Loss of hair. These conditions, or nosebleed, or diarrhea, should be reported to a doctor, unless civil defense teams have warned that your area is still dangerously radioactive. You can get out and work to help yourself and help others. Learn protection from radioactive fallout.
Minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of January in the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. It's funny because it's true, Don. Or words to that effect. No, it's terrifying because it's true. It's funny because it's terrifying.
It can be all of those things.
That's right. It is a true thing that is also funny and yet is terrifying.
It's terrifying but true.
There's something there. I'll have to go back and figure it out. That 2 minutes, that is part of a 15-minute film called Fallout and You. And it's just got that, and it's the, there once was a turtle by the name of Bert.
Kind is
of
that the duck and cover song?
It's not the same video, but it's, I think it's by the same company, or quite possibly a knockoff. You don't really think about there being like a lot of competing ad dollars, you know, for radiation sickness awareness films. But I think there must have been. I think the duck and cover film, that was sort of the, I think that was like the Nirvana Nevermind of that era. And then this may have been sort of a Bush 16 Stone sort of a thing. Or like a Stone Temple Pilots kind of to the other films, Eddie Vedder. So I'm going to sort of piece that out of these various components. We'll play it over the next couple of weeks. I found this giant cache of videos at home that I thought that I had lost. And they are all like classroom safety films from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, including the one. Have you seen the video where the retarded girl gets told about her period? Oh, my God.
I don't know. I don't think so. I'm pretty sure I would remember that.
Oh, it's so great. And it's just like I don't mean to be cruel. It's just, it's the girl with the foldy eyelids. And she's like, you know, and it's a whole lot of, what's her period? You know, and the mom, it's the only other voice I can do. So I'm making her like a Warcraft player. But then it's like the teacher has to explain because the mom, I think, doesn't want to talk to her about her lady parts and her uterine lining. And so there's a whole...
And who can blame her, really?
It's great. I have that courtesy of our friend Squid at KNRK, by the way.
Do you have the Disney menstruation film?
Yes. No, we've played that.
Because I remember actually seeing that as a child during our, like, separating the boys and the girls into different, you know, groups so that we could watch our hygiene films. And for years, I told people that it's like, I saw this movie. I swear to God, it was Disney. But it was about menstruating. And people said, no, you are crazy.
No, eventually.
It was like, no, it did exist.
No, that's it. No, we have that, actually. Hold on a second. I think I've actually got it. I swear to God, it's just called, it's right here. I have a whole folder for these things. I believe it is just called The Menstruation Speech. Wait, hold on a second. Let's just give it a little bit of a, let's see.
To most girls, the menstrual period should bring no severe discomfort. Some girls have a little less pep, a feeling of pressure in the lower part of the body, perhaps an occasional twinge or a touch of nerves. But don't let it get you down. After all, no matter how you feel, you have to live with people. You have to live with yourself, too. Not only can you bathe, you should bathe. Because during menstruation, your perspiration glands are working overtime.
That's good advice, Don.
Are they ever?
Just be careful to avoid either very hot water or very cold water.
Aim for the tepid.
Exercise is good for you during menstruation. Just
also, plus you're
sense.
Gushing blood from your lady parts, so
when
you might want to bathe.
Most of your daily routine is on the mild side. It's going to extremes that's wrong and to be avoided. And once you stop feeling sorry for yourself and take those days in your stride...
And speak when spoken
to. ...you'll find it easier to keep smiling and even-tempered.
Have a manageable goal.
Do something about that slouch. Slumpy posture is just as bad inside as it looks outside.
Look at the floor.
So stand up straight and let the organs function from the position that nature intended.
Also, masturbate, because orgasms are good for cramps.
It's smart to keep looking smart. That well-groomed feeling will give you new poise and lift your morale, especially when it's backed up with year-round fresh air and sunshine and plenty of rest and sleep.
Hide your bodily functions
because
from men.
The best possible insurance against trouble on those days is healthy living every day.
Healthy living.
And that's the story. There's nothing strange nor mysterious about menstruation.
Well, that's not true.
Now get
All
back in your hut.
It's built on cycles. And the menstrual cycle is one normal and natural part of nature's eternal plan for passing on the gift of life.
Yeah, so there you go.
Sadly, those of us who have no intention of passing on the gift of life still have to put up with that eternal mystery every damn month.
Yeah, that's in the same collection of films, but this was one that I think I had played a couple years ago, and so I had it set aside. And it was one of those things that every now and again at home I would have this sort of, like, I would find a stack of data file DVDs or CDs or just like a hard drive or something that I had misplaced, and I would think to myself, well, perhaps it's on, you know, it's on this CD. Perhaps it's on this unlabeled bit of storage that I've never, you know, that I've never looked through. And it never was. And then last night, I just found a whole slew of them. So
nice.
So I figured we would start today with Fallout and you. The best part is when the guy, he looks like, the guy in the Fallout film looks like one of those, what was that series? I think it was in the 70s. And it was sort of like a Richard Scarry kind of a knockoff. And it wasn't the... That series where it was like Mr. Grumpy and Mr., you know, and Miss Happy, and, you know, that was like the Mr. Men series. Yeah. But I think it was the Human Beans cartoon. Human Bean, that's B-E-A-N. Mm-hmm. And so they were just sort of the anthropomorphized bean-shaped. They were like stick figures, but they weren't sticks. They were just sort of like these oblong, you know, these sort of like weirdly rounded rectangles.
He looked like somebody from the Mr. Bean series. And when the guy is going through the whole list of things like, your hair may fall out, your intestines may liquefy, you may gush blood from the ears, and it shows the guy in front of the crudely animated mirror, and all of the things are happening to him, and it just shows him looking up and doing kind of a, oh no, and all of his hair falls onto the floor. Aww. And then there's like lightning bolts sort of around his midsection, I think to indicate the liquefaction of his innards. And the thing is, and it's the way they're describing it, I mean, it just could be anything. It's just like this horrible conglomeration of symptoms that could represent, like, maybe it's fallout, maybe it's like bad dim sum, maybe it's Ebola Marburg. There's just no way to tell. So it's, no, I'll bring the whole thing in at some point.
It could be his period.
Stop that slouching.
He wasn't engaging in healthy living.
Don't talk back. Don't try to vote without your husband's permission. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. We are high above the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. It is Tuesday, and welcome to Day 12. Thank you for coming by. It's 503-505-6964. It's 503-505-6964. If you would like to engage with us telephonically, with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, whatever it is that you might have. You can also text us if you like via Skype. That is Rick Emerson Show. That is our Skype username, Rick Emerson Show at Skype. If you want to email, you can do that as well. It is rick@rickemerson.com. It's rick@rickemerson.com. And Don Taylor can be emailed. If you have observations, perhaps, about how to get through those days and every day, Don awaits your suggestions and your helpful advice at Don, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com.
Or if you want to hear how I get through those days, those special days.
By the way, somebody is noting that the woman of the Disney menstruation film sounds like the drunk Judy Garland tapes, which is completely true. Oh, man, that's
it
another thing.
Is.
I don't think I've played those in years. Oh, I got to dig those up and bring them in. All right. It is Tuesday. Here's what's coming up today. We got your Clown Watch on the way, Geek Watch on the way. Aaron Duran will be joining us with the Week in Geek. The Geek Watch, by the way, will consist of some Apple news, because, you know, it's what we do. Also, I have not bothered to create, like, an actual standalone Apple Watch. So we'll just do that as part of the Geek Watch today. Also coming up later on today, Mr. Jason Leung is going to join us. We pre-taped the interview with him yesterday. I'm going to sort of try to pass it off as brand new. We pre-taped it yesterday morning. Playback later on today. He's the author of this all-encompassing trip, Chasing Pearl Jam Around the World, which is actually, it looks like a fantastic book. There's excerpts of it on the site, and so I read these large sections of it on his website, and our good friend listener Jenny has met him several times, because it's, you know, because she and her husband will do, they don't sort of follow the band around for long stretches of time, but I think they'll go to like 3, 4, 5 shows in a row, which I think Court has done too. I think Court has done that because he's a huge Pearl Jam fan, and they've got that whole thing going on where it's like the shifting set list, where they don't really tour with, you know, they don't tour with like a whole setup and with a whole, you know, like a lot of bands, you can tell that the set list never changes because the lighting, and if like bands that do like pyro and costume changes, you know, any band who does stuff like that, they have to have it down to a science, you know, like just sort of a spreadsheet, because you can't be screwing with that stuff in the middle of the tour. And I guess the deal with Pearl Jam, who I have not seen, I mean, I haven't, you know, it's been years since I've been in the same city where they were playing, and I've had the time and the wherewithal to go see them. But I guess they kind of just do the thing that, like, Zeppelin used to do, where it was just, like, they just get, it's, like, just the band and the instruments and a couple of spotlights, and, like, that's it. And they just sort of, every night, they just, every show is different than the, that's how that thing they did that jazz, like, 6 or 7 years ago, where I swear to God they put out, like, sort of, like, bands will put out the officially sanctioned bootlegs, but I think they put out, like, a 25, like, it was 25 different volumes. It was 25 shows, each of them, like, 3 discs in length or something, because none of the 25 shows were the same, and they were all from the same tour. Anyway, so this guy, Jason Leung, has written this book, this all-encompassing trip, Chasing Pearl Jam Around the World. So we're going to have that interview later on today.
And welcome to any new listeners we might have today because of that, because Jenny did go on the Facebook.
And is that true?
To tell all of her Facebook, her Pearl Jam cronies, that we would be doing this interview today. So if they wanted to sign up for Rick Emerson, the Rick Emerson Show, and listen, that they should hop on it.
I like the idea of somebody signing up because they want to hear an interview with the Pearl Jam guy, and then just as like a bonus, getting menstruation tips.
Yeah.
And also how to keep your internal organs from liquefying, or how to, you know, or just how to sort of present yourself, you know, in a respectable fashion, should that happen.
You can learn a lot from our show.
Really, it's true. It's you never leave here dumber than when you arrived. I mean, when you walk out the door,
you might feel dumber.
Your head is just jam-packed full of of knowledge. You know, it's sort of like someone is. It's like your head is a sad, deflated volleyball that we have just hooked up to some pneumatic hose, and we have filled it with tasty wisdom and nougat just to near seam-splitting levels. You probably have to go home and really just take like a sort of mental hibernation for several hours just to sort of process all of the facts that have been jammed into your cerebellum during your listening time.
You need to lay down for a little while because your head now weighs more.
That's right.
Because of all the stuff in it.
So we got the Clown Watch coming up today. Geek Watch, also Week in Geek with Mr. Aaron Duran. Our interview with Jason Leung. We've got Don Taylor, who is tracking the following headlines for you on this Tuesday.
Tech companies fight to keep Boy Scouts' perversion files a secret. Westboro Baptist Church says they'll show up at shooting victims' funerals, but Arizona residents take issue with that. And the abortion rate is up for the first time in over a decade.
That's one of those things where I had to stifle a woohoo because I, it just seems like it's in poor taste. And also, you just never know whether that's good news or not, you know? So, guess it all depends on which side of the freakonomics line you fall down on. Thank you for joining us. It is 503-505-6964, the Rick Emerson Radio Program today brought to you by, among other fine businesses, EH Vending. Find out more about them by going to ehvending.com. That is ehvending.com. And if you are the owner or operator of a business, you're going to be starting your own company. Or if you're just a colossal load and you don't like to stand up and move too far around your house to get snack items, like if the plaid pantry is an unacceptably long distance from your couch, they could just install the vending machine probably right in front of your toilet if you'd like. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, if it's just too much work, I don't even like to walk to the kitchen. They could just, or you could just have like a machine that dispenses like Caramello bars and Depends. And then like a stick.
Or maybe you just really, really love Snapple and you've always wanted to have one of those big like reach-in refrigerators that has the Snapple sign on top of it that says Snapple. You know, like when you go to the convenience store.
Yes.
They could rent you one of those.
Well, it's like when you go to anytime you go to a deli or something, and they have the cooler that is sort of, it's the branded cooler, and it says Pepsi or it says Mountain Dew or something on the side, because it's not just vending machines. It is, of course, we've talked about the coffee setup. We've talked about the soda machine. We've talked about that. You know what I want to know?
Refrigeration system.
I want to know if they do that weird thing that's like a standalone automat. You know what I'm talking about? Where it's like a little plate with the sliding plastic doors, and you're reaching inside to get and it's always, I'm not going to say something bad, but it's always like, the variety there is somewhat limited. And I think that's just a function of, that's not a function of like, the company.
Yeah.
I think that's a function of the business. And they just sort of go like, well, just give me whatever. And so you get like the stock variety. And it's like egg salad all the time. And it's always in hospitals. Every time I've ever had to like wait in a hospital, in a lobby, or if they've been waiting on somebody who's getting some sort of somebody waiting to visit a relative, or somebody getting a procedure done or something, and you go over to the machine, and it's just tuna salad, egg salad, and then that weird thing that is like a hard-boiled egg with like a little salt packet. And that's it. And those are the only three things that are ever left there. Just like the Schweppes tonic water is the only thing that's ever left in the vending machine at those places. All right. You remember those cigarette vending machines? That it's like that, which I don't even know if they sell these anymore. Like in bars, where it's like you would just stick like your dollar or your $2 in it or whatever, and you pull the lever, and then it would
great.
Just drop the cigarettes into the little bin below with a sort of satisfying papery thud.
Yeah,
do they still have
those? There was that whole ratchety ching ching sound with the pulling thing.
Is that a thing that they still do?
I don't know.
I heard that
a lot of bars got rid of them because
the children.
Children could just come and use them, but
and anyone did, by the way. By anyone, I mean me, because my dad or my grandmother, whoever had me at a bar, and. There must have been some sort of laissez-faire approach to children being in bars, too, when I was a kid, because it seems like I spent a lot of time in taverns with my dad. Maybe that was the reason I was there, as I was like some sort of a trained... I was like a trunk monkey, but I wasn't so much in the trunk. I was just sitting next to him at a bar stool, drinking like a Will Rogers or something, while he was... is that a drink?
It is. That's the male version of the Shirley Temple.
I'm lying. I actually had a Shirley Temple, but I was trying to look a little bit more manly there by saying I was drinking a Will Rogers, and I realize now that that's just stupid.
By the way, last week, over the Christmas holiday, I don't know if it's still available because it was seasonal, but 7-Up had a pomegranate-flavored 7-Up. And I first had the sugar-free version, and it was delicious. And I asked Patrick to buy me some at the grocery store, and he accidentally bought the kind with sugar in it. And, the grenadine syrup that they make Shirley Temples out of, it is actually pomegranate juice, or at least...
Is that what
grenadine
is?
Traditionally, it was pomegranate juice. Now, I think it's just red sugar syrup.
Right.
But when we were kids, it was actually pomegranate syrup. And so the big bottle of the fizzy, delicious, pomegranate-flavored 7-Up, it was like having just a giant bottle of Shirley Temples. It was so delicious, and it was so...
Were you just tempted just to drink it straight out of the... just to hook the hose to your mouth?
I almost went out and back out to buy a jar of maraschino cherries just so I could have the whole experience.
Just have have them hanging like from an IV buddy and just flowing directly into your mouth.
But it was so ridiculously delicious, and then I had that kind of emotional sort of time travel thing.
Oh, my childhood.
Oh, sitting in a bar watching my mom and my grandma get hammered on Manhattans. Ah, those were the good old days.
Oh, by the way, somebody's clarified it's not a Roy. It's a Roy Rogers, not a Will Rogers.
Right.
Will Rogers is the humorist.
Yes.
Roy Rogers was a TV. He was a movie cowboy,
yes,
along with Dale Evans, right?
Yes.
And Trigger and so forth. All right. Okay. So there you go. Whatnot. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. By the way, somebody is noting that if you had a vending machine placed in front of the toilet, he says you'd be like a vending machine human centipede.
You kind of would.
Yeah. I wish I hadn't read that. Thank you for.
I'm sorry.
You're adjusting a boob?
No, I have a weird itch on my boob. I'm sorry. It's gross that I'm reaching in and scratching my breast.
No, that's okay.
Itch.
No, I do, because it doesn't look like scratching. It just looks like you're fondling yourself.
Oh, okay.
So that's how I'm going to choose to remember this moment right now. And I'll go, hey, remember yesterday when you were fondling your boob? And you'll say, I was scratching. And I'll say, it'll be like...
Not to me, you weren't.
It's going to be like a mammary Rashomon, you know, where I will remember something totally different. I'll remember you like twirling around something and then just sort of, you know, cupping yourself. I'm sorry for all of this. Hello, new subscribers. Thank you for joining us today, fools. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. So, again, we got Clown Watch coming up today, Geek Watch coming up, Aaron Duran with The Week in Geek, Mr. Jason Leung, who's the author of This All-Encompassing Trip, and the aforementioned stories by Don Taylor. And then I've got this little piece of etiquette. I got this right here. I have an etiquette question from listener Jeff. And I believe that Jeff was, I believe he was referred to a few weeks ago by somebody else. I believe Jeff is a guy who maybe listened a long time ago and then wasn't aware that we were back and now is listening. Or I think more likely, I think this is the truth, I think Jeff had never listened but had a friend, and many of you may have been the friend in this dynamic, had a friend that just went on and on about the show, like to an almost off-putting degree, and that I think he finally just said, fine, for the love of Christ, I'll listen to the show if it'll make you shut up. And so now he's, you know, and so now he has become that guy, and he himself is spreading the word. And his name is Jeff Futzer. And I think we gave him I think we had the Christmas salutation of a cheers for Futzer. So anyway,
I have received many the email from Jeff Futzer.
So Jeff Futzer has an internet sort of etiquette question for us that we're going to get to in just 1 second. Little bit of business. I will say, joining us tomorrow on the Rick Emerson Show, I do believe that Mr. Aaron Mesh is going to be here. And then Friday, Big Jim Willig will be here with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. We'll also be talking about his comedy show, which is going to be happening at the Baghdad this Friday. And then this coming Saturday, Aaron Duran is going to be doing a signing for his new comic book, La Brujia, that is going to be happening at Bridge City Comics from 6 to 9 p.m. That is this Saturday, the 15th.
There's so much. When do we rest, Rick Emerson? When do we rest?
When we're dead, Don. That's it. We shuffle off our mortal coil. That is when we can finally shut our eyes and have a modicum of peace. Until then, we work for the benefit of all. I don't really have anything important or interesting to say here, except that I, despite my own best intentions, and I really had intended to exercise some sort of willpower or self-control, which I should know at this point is just a losing battle. But, you know, I did that whole thing of power loading the most recent three seasons of House. So I got all the way to the end of season 6. And then I watched the first episode of season 7 because I want to sit there and just have it be a stupid cliffhanger. Because there's that, you know, spoiler, there's a whole thing where, like, he's rescuing the chick from underneath the building and then she snuffs it. And so he's all sad, and so Cuddy humps him. And then it was, which I kind of knew because I think we had, like, a little soundbite or something when they were doing a junket to promote the season. And I sort of knew that that was going to happen. But I thought, well, I'll just watch the first. And so now I'm doing that stupid thing, though, where I'm getting caught up. And it's like pretty soon I'm going to be completely caught up, and then I will have to have to take it as they parcel it out to me, like a morphine drip, you know.
To watch TV like poor people.
Yeah, just clicking the button and waiting for the next life giving bit of House essence to come out. And it's just, you know, so I'll either have to watch it once a week, or, which is to be fair, how I was watching Sons of Anarchy, or I'll have to just wait whatever, like 3 months, and then catch up all at once. So I don't know what. But here's the thing about House. That I have realized. I can forgive the fact that every sick person in the Western Hemisphere seems to end up at this hospital. I can forgive the fact that, I swear to God, I was watching it this morning, and he just willfully walked into, like, an isolation tank that, for all he knew, was filled with smallpox, like, to make a point. Well, I'll show you, and he, like, shh, and he took off the like CDC like Devo suit that he had on that was protecting him, you know, one of those like the Abyss outfits, and he just walked it. Well, if I really believed there was smallpox, would I do this? And just, you know, it was sort of the dancing around inside, and then, you know, and then of course it all went wrong, and then it went right at the very end. So I mean, I guess I can swallow that as the sort of premise of the show, because like you've got to, I guess you have to just, you have to just get past the fact that he is like a savant, not unlike Sherlock Holmes himself. I mean, I guess I can be okay with that. If you buy that he is a sort of, if he's a sort of misanthropic medical rain man, I guess that that's okay. That is the premise which one must buy. Just like for the West Wing, you have to sort of accept that somebody who is just like as unbelievably mind-bogglingly liberal as Jed Bartlett would get elected in this country. And get re-elected, by the way, after lying to everybody about having an incurable disease. So, you know, if you can't buy that, then there's no show. So, I mean, I guess I can sort of be okay with that. Here's the what I have realized is that now that they've done the thing, I don't know what your sense is and how you feel about shows that give into the will they, won't they question by just having the character eventually hump and then get together sort of Dave and Maddie style. Because usually that never, I mean...
It almost never works.
I'm trying to think right now of a show where that has worked and where it has either helped the show or has at least not hurt the show. And I don't know that I can think of anything off the top of my head, a show where they did that and it didn't just have disastrous consequences. I mean, the only shows I can think of where the characters finally got together and then it wasn't like a huge train wreck. I mean, I guess maybe like Sports Night, that didn't really count because they canceled it before it could do anything.
People usually say Cheers, but honestly, Cheers was so spotty.
You mean
spotty.
With
Shelley Long.
With Shelley Long? Well, no, because then they... I don't even remember how she left the show. What was the reason that her character left the show on Cheers?
I don't remember.
I remember she left because she was a whore and nobody liked her. And also she wanted to make more Money Pit style films. She wanted to. She thought that Outrageous Fortune was going to be the way she was going to make her bones in this world. I don't remember why the character left. Isn't it? Let me ask you this: is it a thing? Am I remembering this wrong? Is it a thing with Cheers where like at the end? When they were doing the big, like, the finale where everybody was like, you know, and you were there, and you were there. But it was like her character was just on the phone because they didn't even want to have her back at the set to film the episode. Am I remembering that wrong?
I don't know. Quite possibly. I realized I saw an episode of a rerun of Cheers a few weeks ago and realized that other than the characters
right.
themselves, I remember almost nothing about that show.
It was kind of a plotless program. It really was. You know what Cheers was in many ways? Cheers was, I've thought about this actually, I was going to say disproportionate, but that's only disproportionate outside the studio. Within the studio, it's entirely proportionate. Cheers was sort of not the original, but maybe the best example I can think of in our recent past, in our lifetimes, in our formative years. It was a comfort show because you don't really remember like, again, you remember the characters. You don't remember a lot of jokes. Other than, like, Norm, there were no catchphrases from the show, really. You know, there were a lot of setups or a lot of things that were really notable. The only notable things were when characters left or died. You know, like when Coach died, or at the end, because again, it's like, what's her name? Shelley Long. Was it Diane? Was it her character's name? She left, and then I think, honestly, she came back on the phone because she was just such a skag and nobody wanted her around. So there was that. But apart from that, what you remember is the setting. And I think that's what made that show so endearing for people, is it just seemed like It was just as the theme song promised. It was a place that you wanted to be. It was a place that you yourself wished you could spend your days or your evenings or your whatever. Where, by the way, no one ever seemed to be actually drunk. Which is sort of a...
No.
I wondered about that a lot as a kid. I didn't really... A lot of people have joked about, like, nobody ever paying their bar tab. I just wondered how nobody seemed to ever become intoxicated, no matter how much beer they were putting down while they were there. And no one ever seemed to point out that it was a bad idea for a recovering alcoholic to own and operate a bar, either. That was a thing that just... We all kind of turned a blind eye to that, kind of willfully.
Which was originally the whole premise. It was like, that's part of how they sold the show, was, you know, he plays this ex-baseball star who's a recovering alcoholic, but he owns a bar. But it ended up, like, really...
I don't think it was ever referenced.
Nothing
like
to do with the plot, really. I remember one specific thing from Cheers in that way that really pointless things get burned into your head forever from, like, probably one thing from every TV show you've ever seen.
Is it, let me guess, is it Woody Harrelson's song that he composed for his girlfriend Kelly?
No, okay. It is the song that Coach composed to remember facts about Albania.
Can you perform part of it?
I can. It was an episode where Coach went to night school, and so Ted Danson decided to go to night school as well, and he was having trouble studying. So Coach was telling him that he has this special device for remembering things, that he made up little songs.
Okay.
So the song went like this. Albania, Albania, you border on the Adriatic. Your terrain is mountainous, and your chief export is chrome.
That's fantastic. All right. Thing is, I don't remember that, but I can see how if you had seen that, especially in, like, 1987, I mean, compared to the vast wasteland that was network television, that probably seemed like intellectual humor. I mean, that seemed so brainy it would almost pass as like British comedy, like in the Huxtable era. So,
but I also have now I have this inextricable link between the country of Albania and that song now. So if ever on the news or anywhere there is a mention of Albania, I think, well, you know, their chief export is chrome.
Whenever anybody mentions Albania, you know, the song I get in my head is that Grandpa fought for the 303 from Wag the Dog. Mm. That's it. And the old shoe thing that Willie Nelson sings. The song I remember from Cheers is that Woody spends all this time composing a song for his girlfriend, Kelly. And then the song is just Kelly, 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 Kelly. And that's it. And it's the dumbest thing. There's just no reason that my brain should be. That's like one of those things that I wish that I could open my head with some sort of, you know, with a device and then just take a fish scaler and just cut that part out of my brain and get rid of it. You know, not even that, like, to put something more useful there, just that it bugs me that knowledge is sticking around in my head like some sort of a, you know, there's just some sort of a cerebral barnacle just clinging to the underside of my stem. In any event, what was I talking about? Oh, the will they or won't they? So the will they or won't they thing, it's so difficult for that to happen on a show and for it not to just sabotage the entire thing. Because the thing is, even if they do it, then they have to find reasons to keep putting the relationship in jeopardy again. Or to make one of them, usually the woman, say, this was a terrible idea, where they don't actually break up, but it's like she's constantly having second thoughts. Which, as much as I loved, like, the second season of Californication, that was the thing they did there, where they kept having to, like, inject this instability. The thing on House, though, is I've realized this. There's no earthly reason that they should be together.
No.
They have, first of all, they have no chemistry. Like the actor, like Hugh Laurie and Lisa Edelstein, and I like both of those actors individually. Because Hugh Laurie, of course, is great because he was, he was on Blackadder and the show he did with Stephen Fry.
A Bit of Fry and Lawyer.
Yeah. And
also he and Stephen Fry were Jeeves and Wooster.
And so he's brilliant. Lisa Edelstein, who I liked a lot, she was on Sports Night and she was also on The West Wing. And, she's a fantastic actress. And they're both great. They have no personal chemistry. The characters have no chemistry. And I was actually asking myself this. I actually said out loud to myself, it reached this nadir inside my own head. Where I said, I could say that it was to the dog, but it wasn't even that. It was just to the thin freaking air in my office. When Cuddy said something, or rather, you know, she was like, it was when she was forbidding him to get a massage because the masseuse was also a hooker that he used to bang. And it's like he wasn't having sex with the hooker anymore. He was just getting massages from the hooker because, you know, and he was clearly sincere about this, that, like, the hooker was the only one who could give him massages that actually alleviated his leg pain. And it was obvious, you could tell from that, because he has that one House. Hugh Laurie does that thing where you can tell when House is putting on sincere face. You know, it's when he's finally, you know, it's just for one moment you see his innate humanity shine through. And so he had, like, sincere inflection happening, and you could tell that he was really not having sex with a hooker. He really did need the massage. But Cuddy was being, you know, very, you know, using that premise. She was being very intolerant and said that she was going to dump him unless he stopped getting the massages. And I asked myself, I said, why is he even dating her? And there was no answer from within my own brain. I came back with nothing.
Yeah, there was. I actually liked the backstory that at some point in their distant past,
in college,
they had slept together. And he, like, on the one hand, yeah, he still, you know, maintained a little bit of a torch for her. But mostly that he was just needling her. He just liked needling her. That was great. That was awesome. Them together makes no sense. It doesn't make any sense for either of them. And the thing with her, I love Hugh Laurie. I really do. And I love the character of House. But I got to tell you, everything that we've learned about him and throughout the course of his life and his existence and how he lives his life, I always have this feeling that he probably smells kind of bad.
I would agree with that because he always is A, unshaven and has a thin sheen of viscous sweat on
him. And he's always just, and for most of the time we've watched the show, he's been addicted to drugs.
He's been a drug addict.
He's been a drug addict. He falls asleep in his clothes all the time.
He consorts with whores constantly.
So I always just imagine he's one of those guys whose clothes just smell like stale sweat.
Yeah.
And you know, and yeah, and it's like, I just couldn't see her, like, you know, wrestling up. Yeah, I love the character, and I love him, but it's impossible for me to find his character sexy, because I just always imagine he must just reek.
Yeah, I just, and I think my thing is, this, looking at her character, there's nothing, it's not like her character, you know.
There's nothing in this for her.
And I was going to say that from his perspective, there's nothing really desirable about Cuddy as a girlfriend.
No.
I mean, I'm not saying she's unattractive. She is. But as they've established on the show, it's not like inexplicably he doesn't have trouble getting women. So even though, again, with the reek and the filth. Apart from the fact that she's hot and all, like, so what? I mean, there is no quality in Cuddy that is not present in, like, any, as opposed to House, who at least is unique. I mean, he has distinct traits that are that only he possesses on that show. There are no traits that Cuddy possesses that are discernibly different from those possessed by and displayed by on a regular basis any number of female characters on the program. There is nothing he could get from her as a person that he could not get from any other character. The only reason they finally paired them up is they were just out of ideas.
Yeah.
That's the thing. They were just out of options. And my final observation about this, because clearly I have no willpower, and I'm just going to continue watching the show. So I think I've only got one left, which means I think I'm almost caught up with, like, the rest of the world. Because I don't know if you watch it every week. I think you watch it live,
yeah.
Right? You watch it when it comes out.
Yeah.
So I think I'm like 2 weeks back.
Or the next day.
So I am very nearly caught up. So it's not like I felt sort of bad coming in and discussing, like, season 5 of House or something, because I knew that most people probably watched it a couple years ago. But now I'm almost caught up with the rest of the world. Realizing how little anything changed with him once he got committed to the loony bin and quit taking drugs.
I had hoped that they were going to actually continue that throughout the entire season. That was going to be sort of a theme for the season, that he was going to be dealing with things, his own stuff, but also was going to be, like, solving mysteries
right.
and stuff, you know, while he was committed. Because I thought, wow, what an interesting direction to take the show in.
No.
And then, you got, like, 2-3 episodes with it, and it was like they went right back to the same old stuff.
Well, that's like my thing. There was this sort of, like, rumor going around. It was on Ain't It Cool, I think. So, I mean, you know, I should have known better. But there was this rumor going around about the Dexter season finale for this just concluded season 5 of Dexter, that Dexter was actually going to get caught, that his sister was going to figure it out, which I think she does in the books. The sister, that Deb was going to figure it out, he was going to get caught, he was going to go to jail, and then the season would actually follow Dexter in prison, which would have been, I mean, that's a thing like the Connor family winning the lottery and Roseanne. It would have gone either really, really well or really, really badly. But you know what? I would have given him so many points just for trying something new. You know, I would rather see a failed experiment than see something that just treads water, that just is recycling the same old material and retreading the same ground. You know, something where they swing big and they miss big. That's still interesting to me.
That's like Sons of Anarchy going to Ireland.
Right.
You know, it wasn't always successful, but damn, it certainly was interesting.
And they tried, you know.
Yeah.
And they tried something that they hadn't done before, and they changed the opening credits a little bit for it and everything. And so, I got to give them, I will totally give them big props for that. You know, you'll see, I don't know how far you went in The Wire, but you'll see with The Wire, it's not a drastic change because, again, the 5 seasons are essentially one story. But season 2, it does have... Season two is the most different from all the other seasons of the 5.
Well, doesn't, like, you have the first season, which focuses primarily on, like, law enforcement and the criminal element, and then don't you have a season that goes more into, like, the newspaper aspect of journalists?
Every season of The Wire, the premise of The Wire is that every season analyzes one institution and the systemic failures and corruption of the institution. So there is, I mean, I'm not spoiling anything by telling you this.
No,
so there are no spoilers.
I remember hearing an interview with the creator.
Season 5 is the media. Season 4 is the educational system. Season 3 is the war on drugs, the DEA. Season 2 is labor and unions. And season 1 is effectively just an introduction to the series. So it is season 1 is the most traditional in that it is just an analysis.
It's cops and robbers.
It's cops and robbers, but I mean, it's like they're analyzing the police department itself. But then they get very sort of discreet. They get very specific about the institutions in the following four. Season two, though, maybe because I'd never seen a show that did something like this, that changed gears like that, season two seemed the most different, where I went, wow, this is, am I watching the same show? And then eventually they bring it all back together. You know, The Wire is sort of like, The Wire is, it takes place in one very believable world where everything is connected, but it is sort of like every now and again, the Google map, you know, point of view just hops to the other side of town and zooms in and focuses on like one square block for like 2 or 3 weeks. And then it hops back to another part of town and then back to the first place again. And you see eventually how they are all connected, but it can be a little disorienting at the beginning. But that's sort of interesting. You know, that's the sort of thing that could fail in the wrong hands, but at least it would be, you know, not just going back and chewing the cud. Speaking of House.
A friend of mine, by the way, I wanted to ask you, a friend of mine yes. wanted me to bring this up with you because you've watched all of The Wire. He said that he had a real hard time in the first season with a lot of the Baltimore accents.
Yeah.
And that
you mean in terms of figuring out what the hell they're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said that in ensuing seasons, it didn't seem as difficult. And he wasn't sure if that was him having, like, sort of acclimated to it, or if he thought maybe they had just kind of, you know, not necessarily dumbed that down a bit, but they, like, maybe backed off on the authenticity of the accents a bit to make it more accessible.
That is him acclimating to it. The reason I'll tell you this, well, first of all, because there's been, I read, I think maybe around season four, season five, somebody, there was kind of a niche article about, it might have been in the Baltimore Sun, actually, but they did a little sidebar piece about the accent and about how they don't, you know, the thing about The Wire is, like, they don't stop to explain, especially after the first couple episodes, once they've established it, they don't really stop to explain anything, and that includes dialect, slang, diction, and accent that you may not understand. He got acclimated to it, and I will. I think the proof of that is that in season four, there is a character who has, of all five seasons, the most impenetrable Baltimore accent is on a season. A character who is in season four and five, but who comes to the fore, no pun intended, in the fourth season, that it really becomes more prominent. And it's like you really have to struggle sometimes to try to figure out. You have to use context to figure out what was just said, and to try to figure out what the implication of the statement was, because they don't bother to. And that's again where, like, so many of the actors in that show come from Baltimore, and this particular actor in season four, and everybody who's watching knows what I'm talking about, was not even really an actor. It was somebody just found working as a busboy in a restaurant, and Michael K. Williams, who plays Omar, told David Simon, he's like, you gotta go see so and so works at the restaurant. You know, you gotta find a way to put them on the show. And David Simon went and talked to this person and was like, wow, you know, there was just such a force of I don't want to say energy, but just a force of personality, just a certain charisma, maybe is the wrong word, but a certain compelling magnetism to this person, and it just jumps off the screen. And I guess David Simon went to the restaurant and talked to the person for, like, you know, for like 30 seconds, was like, I'm gonna write something for you, and as a result, it is unintelligible about half the time, but you can sort of figure it out, though. I mean, it's like, and I think that's also that he is true to his own world, that they, I think it is because they don't try to dumb it down, so as a result, while things may be a little bit confusing and the dialect may be hard to follow, I think that because that show does take place legitimately and authentically within the Baltimore world, they don't have to try to tie things together. Things naturally tie together and make a contextual kind of sense because it does take place very organically in this one world. So that'd be my take on it, is that your ear figures it out after a while. But that being said, I know that there are people who will specifically go online and try to find subtitled versions because they find it difficult. But my final thought about House, and then I'll wrap this up, because I can tie these two things together. I can tie The Wire and House together by, you know, because the show that he did before The Wire, one of the shows anyway, was Homicide. And there was this, in the show Homicide, at the end of, I think, the fourth season, Andre Brower's character, they did something really gutsy where they gave him a really traumatic stroke. And the thing of Andre Brower, you know, his character Frank Pembleton, was very verbose, and his gift was with the silk. As he said it, he talked about going into the box and interrogating suspects, and he described his interrogation as being as silver-tongued and thieving an oration as ever moved Bibles or coffins. And he was just very, very gifted and skilled in the sense of rhetoric and oratory, and they took that away from his character by crippling him with a stroke. And it was amazing. And I thought, wow, you know, this show is really going someplace different. They got balls for doing that. And that lasted, when the next season started up, that lasted two episodes. And apparently they got notes from the network saying, like, okay, the viewers find it really awkward and uncomfortable that it's not like it was before. Fix it. And so then, literally in like the third episode, Frank Pembleton, back to normal.
Oh, God.
You know? I mean, he goes from not being able to find his car keys or remember his wife's name or, like, order a pizza on the phone to he's back to his old, irascible, you know, a million words a minute self. And I understand the network made him do it, but it is because the network, you know, was just terrified because the audience was terrified because there was something happening they didn't immediately understand and they were a little uncomfortable with. It's when you realize that movie, the TV set, the Duchovny film, I saw Jake Kasdan, who wrote and directed that, and he somebody referred to it in an interview. They said, "Well, your new film is a very biting and dark satire." And he actually interrupted the interviewer and he said, "There's nothing satiric about my film." He said, "It is the way that television works." So, all right, we're so up our own ass with this conversation.
Oh yeah.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program Week in Geek coming up. Also, we'll have our interview with Mr. Jason Leung. Also, we have Clown Watch, Geek Watch at the news desk. Make way for Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Oh, yeah, news.
Oh, yeah, we did that.
The country's leading technology trade association, which represents major multinationals, including IBM, Boeing, and Microsoft, has written a brief in support of the Boy Scouts of America in a lawsuit that seeks to make public the organization's so-called perversion files.
I like what we're saying.
The files, variously called the perversion or ineligible volunteer files, keep track of suspected pedophiles and others who violate the Boy Scouts of America's rules in an effort to keep them from volunteering again. A Multnomah County Circuit Court judge ruled that 20 years' worth of Boy Scouts' ineligible volunteer files from 1965 to 1985 could be used in court, and in June ruled that they should be opened to the public.
So is this the deal that you go, you interview for a job at the Boy Scouts, and they give you a battery of questions, and then you have to fill out a questionnaire about your personal life, read, are you gay, are you an atheist, and then if they turn you down, they keep that on file so that you can be turned down, like, you know, again in another city if you try later.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And so they are being sued, and so these might be then subpoenaed and revealed.
Right. And so what's happening is this organization called Tech America, which again includes IBM, GE Aviation, Microsoft, a bunch of multinational corporations, they don't really give a damn about the Boy Scouts or about these perversion files.
Right.
They're concerned that if it's ruled that it's okay to open these files, it could open the door to other kinds of files being open to the public, and that means that they would not be able to hold as tightly onto trade secrets. So they are actually filing a brief. They are supporting the Boy Scouts in their effort to keep their perversion files secret.
So what lawsuit is resulting in this, though? Is this people suing because they think that because they're pissed off that the Boy Scouts wouldn't let them join, and so as a sort of retaliatory measure, they want all of this disclosed because they don't like the fact that the Boy Scouts discriminate?
Well, the whole case started when six men sued the Boy Scouts. One of them was molested in the 1980s by an assistant scoutmaster. And he won $1.4 million in damages and an $18.5 million punitive award from the Boy Scouts. Also, the Cascade Pacific Council and the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. The assistant scoutmaster acknowledged the abuse of the man in a deposition before the trial. The groups settled with five of the other guys, but now two of those guys have sued. And in their lawsuits, they want these files opened. So
it's like, did you know so-and-so had a predilection for small boys or whatever?
Right.
Okay, all right.
So Tech America, this trade organization, is basically arguing that opening the files would mean there's no judicial protection of trade secrets by private organizations.
It doesn't really sound like not hiring boy rapers isn't a trade secret. I mean, you'd think that's just, you know.
But again, though, it is...
That's the thing we've all figured out.
It is the convolutions of law.
Yeah, I guess.
You know?
All right.
So Microsoft, through their PR firm, confirmed that they're a member of Tech America, but they declined to comment on the...
You know, it's weird when you see those things where it's like the... like, I remember during the... Was it during the Monica Lewinsky thing where there was like some bit of insanity where like James Dobson and Focus on the Family were filing a joint lawsuit with the National Organization for Women or something? Because they were both doing some sort of friend of the court, like amicus filing, because they both kind of came down on the same side of the issue, which is that Bill Clinton was a weasel, because now we're saying that, like, you know, you know, that he was abusing his, you know, his position, and, you know, and of course James Dobson just didn't like him because it was, you know, the sex, and so they filed.
He was having too much fun.
Exactly. They thou shalt not enjoy thyself ever, and so they found like this weird common ground where they were filing some lawsuit about this, and it was one of those things where you realize that the strange, as you said, the strange judicial overlap of these things and the precedents that are sometimes set, and Microsoft, especially, is one of those companies that they are not. They can be sort of freakishly secret about stuff, just like Google is. You know, they're sort of notorious for keeping their trade secrets, for anything that they even perceive to be a trade secret. As we were talking about the M&M Mars company last week, where they're like the most notorious example of companies that are completely paranoid about things that you wouldn't think would be secret at all. Like, you know, like, why did you reissue red M&Ms? But they just go bonkers about it. And I guess maybe that is the thing that Mr. Moore once said, that only the paranoid survive, I guess. So, all right. Well, there's that. We should do, like, one more, and then we'll do the Week in Geek here.
Well, let's do our Clown Watch.
Hooray! I was so hoping you'd say Clown Watch. Here's your Clown Watch for Tuesday.
A man wearing a clown mask and armed with a gun robbed a Shell station on Silver Street in Dover, New Hampshire, on Monday morning.
Dover.
Police said the man entered the gas station at about 12:30 a.m., flashed a handgun, and demanded the clerk turn over the money. The clerk handed over the undisclosed amount of cash, and the clown robber fled out the door on foot, heading west toward the old McIntosh College building.
Where is this story from?
You can tell this is New Hampshire.
I was just going to ask I should be looking near that building now.
He headed out towards the old McIntosh place.
Okay.
He's described as a white male, about 5'9 to 5'10, wearing a clown mask with red and white lips and wide eye holes, blue jeans, a black Carhartt-style jacket, and black gloves. Anyone with information about clowns is asked to call the Dover, New Hampshire. Place.
Coincidentally, I really prefer girls with wide eye holes. All right, there's your Clown Watch for Tuesday on the... Have you ever stopped to listen to this? God, this is really upsetting.
It is very upsetting.
It's a little trill at the end that I like there. Yeah. A little sort of, you know, a little Music Man kind of a coda. All right, here's the Rick Emerson radio program still to come. We will have our interview with Mr. Jason Leung. He's the author of This All-Encompassing Trip. We'll also have The Week in Geek headed your way in just moments, a full-on Geek Watch coming up in a bit. And we'll talk more about E.H. Vending and this whole business of the Name That Snack contest, which this is going to have to be, I think, a serious rejiggering of this somehow. This has to be an augmentation and an altering, because... After we haven't even announced what yesterday's was, we'll announce the winner of yesterday's, you know, of the most recent round, which I think yesterday was clue number two, and it was like we gave the clue, and then like 10 seconds later, Cheryl sent me something. She's like, "No lie," she's like, "Some jackass just," she didn't say jackass, that's me adding that, but she said like, "No lie," like somebody just figured it out, and I think you and I and Ryan White were all like, "How in the name of Christ would you have figured out what that snack food was?" So
I'm thinking that. In order to win the snack foods, they're going to have to guess. We're going to have to give clues for a healthy food.
And
I'll bet they won't know. No one will know.
I was thinking that we ought to just make...
It's red. It looks like an apple. I have no idea what it could be.
I was just thinking that it's like, you know, that really we have... I think we've done our part. In other words, you know, we were initially thinking like it was going to take like... Because we were talking to Josh at EH Vending, and he was like, "Well, how many of these do you estimate you're going to be giving out?" I was like... Maybe one a week, you know, and it's like within the first week, I think we've given out three.
Yeah.
So, you know,
so they're all used. They're going to get mad at us.
God bless those guys. But yeah, it's like they're having to. I mean, not that they're opposed to doing it. He's not complaining in any way. But I feel bad because they're having to like create, you know, like sort of baskets and like get them all ready and drop them off or mail them off or whatever. And
This was going to be like the damn sound thing, and it was going to go on for weeks.
I feel like we have done our part, though, in the sense that we, you know, we offer the audience the chance to win these sort of, you know, gift baskets of, you know, these like great snack foods and vending items, and you know, and any number of desirable of food based prizes. And I think like we've held up our end of the bargain because we've not just given away one; we've given away like 300% of what we anticipated.
Yeah.
So. If whatever we do now is really difficult or just the result in like nobody getting one for 10 days or whatever, I'm not going to feel bad about that at all because it's like we've already given away as many as we thought we would give away in the better part of a month. It's just – I think we ought to just make people do stuff for us basically is what I'm saying. I think we should make people come to the studio and just – you know, literally just come and dance for us.
We could have like two or three guys come in, and whoever can fit the most corn nuts in their mouth, they get the prize.
See, that's the thing. It sounds like a good idea, but...
I know. Then someone chokes.
And... Then someone dies, and then that's, you know, I want to remind you about the... Well, you probably weren't on our show when this happened. Do you remember the Hold Your Wee for a Wee contest?
No, I don't.
Oh, God. Really? I thought that might have penetrated the mainstream media.
No.
All right, and then we'll take a break. Let me just tell you this. I got to wrap it up. We'll just do this here, because otherwise I'll forget. So, working at CBS, and by the way, before I even started there, everybody told me, Bruce Egler, you know, he didn't warn me as such. He just told me, he's like, hey, when you work there, it's like, just, they're a very litigious company, and they're very paperwork heavy. And everybody told me that, like, CBS has paperwork like nobody's business. And it was true. I mean, it was like, it was so difficult to get anything approved there, to do any kind of contest, because you would have to run everything through the legal department, often corporate legal in New York. And it would, like, they would give you, here's an example. I think at one point, Richie Bristol wanted to go on, it was like Judge Judy or one of those judge shows, like Judge Joe Brown or something. And he had, you know, he's Richie, so he's insane. He has, you know, some crazy situation with like a cross-dressing roommate and, you know, and somebody took somebody.
And he did indeed do that. He did go on that
program. He did, but, you know, but it was after he was no longer with CBS, because CBS wouldn't let him do it. And it was like he was the PA on, let's be honest, a zany morning show. But he had to fill out a form that was about half an inch thick and submit it to CBS HR and then corporate HR to determine whether or not just a guy who answered the phones on a wacky rock and roll morning show would be allowed to go on television, which you would think they would want because it's, you know, publicity. And they eventually said no. And they said CBS said that he was not allowed to do that as long as he was in the – and it wasn't like he was being charged with anything illegal or anything immoral. He was the plaintiff because somebody had robbed him of something and he was trying to get it back. But CBS just said, no, this could potentially backfire on us. We're just going to say no. And that was like their reflexive response to everything. Just as the whole thing about not swearing on the air got worse after Janet Jackson's boob got whipped out, the whole thing about CBS just saying no and denying permission for every kind of event and remote and contest, that got a lot worse after this thing happened in California called the, and this is Clear Channel who did this, I believe, Hold Your Wee for a Wee. No, it was Entercom, because we were doing a whole chart about how many of their listeners they'd killed over the years. but it was where the people were, it was when the Nintendo Wii had just come out, and it was the hot item for, I think it was for the holiday season, for the Christmas, as Don Cheadle would say. And every, you know, you couldn't get them. They were sold out, and, you know, you'd go to the stores, and they were, you know, you were waiting in line, and then you have to go home and tell your kid you couldn't get a Wii, and your kid would hate you. And so parents were just doing anything they could to get a Nintendo Wii. They had this idea. Everybody would come into the studio, and they're going to have a water drinking contest. And so these three guys, who don't seem all that like bright to begin with, sit in the studio, and they just drink gallon after gallon after gallon after gallon. And, of course, the moronic DJs just sit there and let them do this. And as much as I'm bitching about CBS telling us we couldn't do stuff, like at no point, just like the general manager, the promotions director, a lawyer, anybody, you know, like, I don't know, a doctor say, like, maybe this is, you know, maybe this isn't such a good idea to have these guys do this. At one point, actually, during the show, listeners who did have medical experience started calling up and saying, this seems like a bad idea. You really ought to stop this. And, you know, and then they would just, you know, yeah, that's really hilarious. Wah, wah, and play like a farting noise and then go back to the water drinking. Anyway, so the long story short is, I think two of the guys ended up in the hospital. The third one just died.
Oh, God.
Just died. Full on died. From basically just being waterlogged. I mean, just saturated his organs to the point that I think he went home and just, I don't feel so good, and just keeled over and was dead.
Well, I hope that fourth guy liked his wee.
Yeah, so it was the Hold Your Wee for a Wee contest.
Jeez.
And once that happened, there was no contest of any kind that required ingesting anything. So like the Playhouse, who I really have to give up to those guys, is whatever anybody thinks about PK and the Playhouse, they really had some of the great contest ideas. They were giving away Britney Spears tickets at one point. And the deal was that the contest was who could fit the biggest number of cigarettes in their mouth at the same time, light them, and then actually successfully smoke them all. And so there was a woman who put, I don't know, something like 45 cigarettes in her mouth at once. And they went around with the lighter and just lit the ends of all 45. And she just went there and went, and was just inhaling 45 cigarettes at once.
Oh.
It's just awesome. I mean, that really is, that's a little bit of genius, but you can't do things like that anymore.
No.
So, you weren't here. Were you doing, it was when Patrick was in the hospital. We had a little crossover with Greg and Sarah a couple weeks ago, and they were trying to see how many quarters they could fit inside Kenny's nose. Did you see the photos of that?
Yes.
Because he's got these absurdly large nostrils. They're comically large. And so they had him, we finally figured out, we tried it both ways. We had him like sitting upright as I am now. And then later, Sarah and I figured out if we like had him lean back in the chair so it became like a little slot or like a tray. And he held $2.50 worth of quarters in his nostrils. That's impressive.
That
really.
Is.
That is, I believe, five each.
Wow.
You know, and the deal is he got to keep. It really, I think at that point we realized we had never stopped being a zany morning show.
Yeah.
He got to keep whatever he could jam into his nose successfully. We could do that. How many corn nuts could you fit inside your ears or something? Mm-hmm. As long as it's not going to cause their airway to be blocked or constricted.
Something could still become infected
Or
something. That's a bad idea.
Speaking of which, you want to be careful about any food you put down on the counter. Over, you know, on that side of the table over there. I wouldn't put anything down over there without a paper towel underneath it. Just FYI.
Why would...
Don't worry about
what's
it.
What's
happening? All right. Coming up, we got your Geek Watch and also our interview with Mr. Jason Leung. That is on the way. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Greetings, programs. Aaron Duran here with GeekInTheCity.com, and this is your week in Geek. First, some good news, bad news in the realm of comics to screen. The bad, it would seem all is not well in the halls of Mighty Marvel as Joss Whedon is butting heads with the studios regarding creative choices and budget cuts on the in-production Avengers film. With Jon Favreau off the Iron Man series and Robert Downey Jr. making snide comments about the movie, this does not bode well for the moody auteur that is Joss Whedon. And the good news? Every studio in the world told David E. Kelley to take a flying leap off the shores of Themyscira with his horrible Wonder Woman series concept. Thank Hera. Next, it is officially on in Middle-earth. Ian McKellen and Andy Serkis have both signed on to reprise their roles as Gandalf and Gollum. Unconfirmed reports claim Hugo Weaving will once again wear the elf ears, and Sir Christopher Lee is in talks to play the wizard Saruman. Thus, Peter Jackson is doing what we all wanted and knew he would do, but it only took him an 8 extra years to admit it. Finally, this Saturday at Bridge City Comics, Geek in the City presents... Wait a minute. Make That Proudly presents the world debut of the soon-to-be classic comic La Brujia. It all starts at 6 p.m. on Saturday, January 15th. Join the Geek in the City crew as they sign copies of their newest book, La Brujia. Bridge City Comics is located at 3725 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland, Oregon. I am Aaron Duran of GeekInTheCity.com, and that was your week in Geek.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
A long, long time ago, in a galaxy far away, Naboo was under an attack. And I thought me and Qui-Gon Jinn could talk the Federation into maybe cutting them a little slack. But their response, it didn't thrill us. They locked the doors and tried to kill us. We escaped from that gas, then met Jar Jar and Boss Nass. We took a bongo from the scene and we went to feed to see the queen. We all wound up on Tatooine. That's where we found this boy. Oh my, my, this here Anakin guy. Maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Did you know this junkyard slave isn't even old enough to shave? But he can use the force, they say. Do you see him hitting on the queen? Though he's just 9 and she's 14. Yeah, he's probably gonna marry her someday. Well, I know he'd be be a Jedi. Now we finally got to Coruscant, the Jedi Council we knew would want to see how good the boy could be. So we took him there and we told the tale how his midichlorians were off the scale and he might fulfill that prophecy. Was impressed, of course. Could he bring balance to the force? They interviewed the kid. Oh, training they forbid, because Yoda sensed in him much fear. And Qui-Gon said, now listen here, just stick it in your pointy ear. I still will teach this boy. He was singing, my Anakin guy, maybe Vader someday later. Now he's just a small fry, and he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying, soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. We caught a ride back to Naboo, 'cause Queen Amidala wanted to. I frankly would have liked to stay. We all fought in that epic war, and it wasn't long at all before little Hotshot flew his plane and saved the day. And in the end, some Gungans died, some ships blew up and some pilots fried. A lot of folks were croaking, the battle droids were broken. And the Jedi I admire most met up with Darth Maul and now he's toast. Well, I'm still here and he's a ghost. I guess I'll train this boy. And I was singing, my, my, this here Anakin guy. Maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying, soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. We were singing, my, my, this here Anakin guy. Maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying, soon I'm gonna be a Jedi.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
As we're sitting here during the break, having a
nerding out,
another nerd conversation about our planners.
And I think that is a nerd thing, not a geek thing, by the way. Because if we were geeks, we would be comparing like apps or, you know, like, I don't know, like software, you know, that would help us track a lot. But instead, we're comparing our at-a-glance paper planners.
I'm dissatisfied with where this extra space is here, because my previous planner, it combined Saturday and Sunday into one square on the right-hand side. But the at-a-glance thing has 4 days on the left and three on the right, with the extra blank area at the top of the right-hand page instead of at the bottom. So I keep thinking that's Friday, but it's not. And it's annoying me.
See, I don't know why they would even create a planner that way. Like, why? What is the point of laying the pages out the way that they have done there? At a glance is very... I'm not saying they're unreliable, because the planner I use is fine. And it, you know, serves me very well. But some of their stuff doesn't make any sense at all. It's like they're trying to just have a lot of different options for the consumer. And so they do things like that, where there's just like, as you said, just like a huge dead space in the middle of one of the pages for no reason.
Then there's all these extra things in the back that I don't really need, like... you know, I think the address book thing is nice, but then they have these special sections like, you know, future planning. That's all it just says, future planning. So I guess if you have things that are coming up in the next year, you can stick them in there for you. Special events.
That's for lunch with Alvin Toffler.
Why would I go all the way back to the back to look at special events when I have an entire book full of specific dates to put things in?
Also, how special can the event be if you're sticking in the back where you put your coupons?
I guess you're supposed to put down everybody's anniversary and birthday and stuff in the back here. So I guess next year you'll transfer it over or something. I don't know.
I'd like to thank the listener, by the way, that just sent us a message that consists of Z's. Thanks. I appreciate that. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. We've got your...
movies to rent. Really?
See, but that's... You know what that is, though? They're just... That is where they have taken a planner from a previous year. They are repurposing it and trying to make it seem like they don't want to discontinue the line because they figure... Look, at the risk of irritating the guy who's just putting Z's again on the screen. Here's the thing, because I would be curious to know, actually, and I don't think we have time to talk about this today, but I would be
not
curious to know.
According to that guy.
We ought to have something we go to that literally is like just reading water tables or something. Like whenever somebody says that the nerd conversation we're having is really just dry and lifeless, there's nothing interesting. We ought to have something where we just start reading, just things out of like... You know, we just read like a shoe catalog, from Des Moines. In any event, by the way, that has been followed by an all caps, LOL, I rule. Okay. I'm just going to minimize.
LOL.
All right. Did I ever tell you about the guy I knew that would say LOL out loud occasionally as a word? This guy named James that I used to work with, and occasionally it's like I wasn't like trolling for laughs. Like I would go in to say something to him, and he'd ask me a question, and I'd say something back in my patented brusque yet witty Rick Emerson way, and occasionally like he would be typing on the computer, and he wouldn't even look at me. He would just sort of like reel back a little bit, and he'd go lol, and then just keep typing, and it was the weirdest thing. And eventually it got to the point where I would tell people about it, and then I would take them into the studio with me, and I would just say something to him to see if I could get him to do it. He was like a lolling dipping bird or something. Like he would just kind of lol, and he would lean back and then like rock back and then rock forward again into his chair and continue typing. It was strange. It was like a stuffed animal that you'd train to do something.
I don't feel bad saying this because I've kind of not really hanging out with these people anymore that were friends of mine for a really long time, but they were like super, super nerdy, super, super geeky and delightful people in many ways. But we're not really spending time together anymore. Our friendship seems to have lapsed.
You have to justify it to me.
Well, I do.
I try not to have friends at all.
I do when I start to say something like, one of the things that drove me crazy is they're the kind of people, and I think in, you know how you have those things where he's like, okay, it is now time to remove myself from this friendship.
Yes.
Now that I have discovered X.
Yes.
And in this case, it's when people spend so much time on the computer that they say te instead of the in conversation.
Aaron Duran does
and
that.
Find it clever.
Aaron, to be fair, I don't think he does it like much anymore, but there was this period of time where Aaron was, he would be like, that is to win. And I think at one point I just said, dude, you have to stop that.
Word is cat. It's not kite with an H at the end because you think that's funny on lolcats.
I think I've heard Bobby do that, fat boy. This is all like from the CBS era because I was like seeing those guys like all the time because we worked right next to each other. So I think that may be like during that window of time when it was sort of amusing. How I'm like constantly trying to bring back Hella. So I think, because there was a window of time and then it lapsed. And so I am ignorant of when it's time to stop saying those things. That was a couple years back. I would like to think that those guys don't say that stuff now. But there was about a week where I experimented with the lol thing because I thought it was like weird enough that it might in some perverse way be funny. But then I realized that it's like it, you know, and I have. I would say that I dislike ironic humor, and that's not true. I mean, it's like there's a time and a place for it, and I thought, well, maybe this is the time and place. I will occasionally just say lol in conversation, but I realized that it was like the irony would be totally invisible. It would not be – the irony detectors of no one would pick that up, and then I would suddenly be another guy
and
like
you'd
that.
You'd be that guy who says lol.
And they'd be like, hey, there's this retard I work with, and he says lol, and then like they would be bringing people into my office suddenly to see if they could make me do it, and it was like I couldn't handle it. On the planner thing, though, I think if we were geeks, we would be talking about an electronic version of this. Nerds, though, I think that's the paper planner. That is clung to by nerds. When I was at the
And dweebs use an abacus.
When I was at the I don't think dweebs have anywhere to be. That's the thing. Dweebs are just sitting there scratching their crotch and sniffing their fingers. That's it. When I was at the WSU branch campus that time when they were having me come out and talk to the tomorrow's hopeful broadcasters, at one point I was, I don't know, I was like making an appointment to come back because they, I did like a half and half visit where I went out there and I was talking to the kids about, you know, like the exciting careers awaiting them in the world of radio or whatever. And then they were going to have.
Fire!
Yes. And then they were going to have me, in my defense, I said like, there are none. Like that is, you know, they don't exist. And then they wanted me to come back a few weeks later and judge their like final projects or something. And so I think it was in the classroom and the teacher said, so can you come back on like the 17th? And I said, let me check. And I pulled out my at-a-glance paper planner, and one of the kids, I mean, it was early 20s or whatever, one of these students there, it was a moment like you really only see on sitcoms or in movies featuring a sort of like, you know, like an aging hipster and young people. It was one of those like honest-to-blog moments where you think people don't really say this stuff like this in the real world. So I said, let me check and see if I'm free on the 17th, and I pull up my paper planner. And I open it, and this kid in the front row looks at me and goes, whoa, analog. And it was – and I looked at him for a second. I was trying to figure out if he was like referencing something, but I think it was just a thing he said. And for a moment, I felt like I was in like an episode of Yo Teach or something. It was so weird. I don't know what the hell we are talking about now. Jesus. We're not even going to get to this netiquette thing probably today. We'll have to do this tomorrow. You know, we should do this tomorrow because Aaron Mesh will be here. And I want to hear him weigh in on this, okay. Actually. So I'm going to fold this up. You people don't think I'm forgetting about this. I'm folding it.
That's
we're going to deliberately.
Sound of folding.
We're going to do that tomorrow. It'll be tomorrow we do that. It'll be a thing we do, I don't know, maybe like 2 o'clock hour tomorrow. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Still to come today, we got your Geek Watch and also our interview with Mr. Jason Leung. So that is on the way. This, however, at the news desk is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
An Ohio school district said it has no plans to take noodles off the lunch menu after boll weevil beetles were found in a package.
Boll weevil beetle is a funny phrase. I thought that the beetle would be redundant there.
No.
Isn't it implied?
I guess. I imagine you could have just said boll weevils.
Are there boll weevil pterodactyls?
I think it's one of those things like saying ninja assassin.
Yeah,
whereas
okay.
If you had said beetles, that's not specific enough. But if you say boll weevils being a subset of beetles, that would have done nicely. They didn't really need to add beetles after that.
Just say it one more time.
Boll weevil beetles. The bugs were found on Thursday when lunch workers at New Boston Local Schools were preparing meals for the district's three schools. Workers strained the bugs from the noodles, then proceeded to cook and serve them to students.
They strained. Well, first of all, can we agree here that the syntax in this sentence is all kinds of strange?
They probably sifted them more than they strained
them. And also, read that sentence back again.
Workers strained the bugs from the noodles, then proceeded to cook and serve them to students. Yeah, it sounds like they cooked and served the bugs.
That's an indistinct sentence is what that is. All right.
The district has noodles planned for lunch one day next week and said it does not plan to change that.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, but that is – so was there somebody agitating for them to get rid of noodles in general or just – were they asking them to get rid of just this bag of noodles? Because that seems like –
we don't trust noodles anymore.
It seems like if you said, look, how about maybe just like that tray of noodles over there you don't use anymore? Like that seems reasonable.
Yeah, but no noodles with bugs.
You know, you just figure – I mean, I don't think it's as true as the urban legend always says, but you got to figure you do inadvertently ingest a bunch of like beetle legs or whatever. Every year anyway, so, you know, it toughens you up.
Yeah. Well, in this case, the district's food services director resigned, and two food service workers were placed on unpaid leave.
This is before the noodles were cooked, though, right?
Yeah.
So they were being cooked, so they were being sterilized anyway.
Yeah, I suppose that...
Bunch of whiners.
Well, again, that's the thing, having worked in the food service industry, having worked in restaurants, there are, because of health department regulations and such, there are different things that you do in a food service capacity than you would do in your own home. I mean, if I was at home and I found beetles in my dried pasta, for example, my dried noodles, it depends on the bugs. But depending on, you know, if there were just a couple of them, I would probably just go, and then go, well, I'm cooking these anyway. Whatever.
That's what I do.
People might not, you know, but if you're working in a restaurant, there are different rules.
But this isn't a restaurant. This is a school.
Well, the same thing, though. It is still professional food service.
You
still have health department rules.
I just figure it's one of those things where at a restaurant you do that because you don't want the word to get out and you lose the meals to your competition.
Yeah.
In a school, you know, they got to be there and you got to eat. So, I mean, you know, I think that's the thing where it's like, you know, when you're at San Quentin, where you go, I don't like it. And they go, okay, you know, and then it's a night in the box for you.
And plus, you know, particularly in a school, you have a really, really tight budget as far as food is concerned. So you don't want to just throw away
extra protein,
possibly like a 3 or 4 or 5 pound box of dried pasta because you found, you know, some bugs crawling around.
Everybody needs to toughen up.
Yeah.
All right. Here's Don Taylor.
Let's do our Geek Watch.
Awesome. Here is your, I got to minimize this. Here's your Geek Watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio program.
Ugh, this high-speed modem is intolerably slow.
In the Quasar Dilemma, remember you used to...
Just a television show. That's all, okay?
Right, but because we were wondering if the quantum flux... Now, just listen on
there. There is no quantum flux. There's no auxiliary. There's no goddamn ship. You got it?
Energize.
Geek Watch item the first. If you've seen the 2007 documentary The King of Kong, you know about the battle between Steve Wiebe and noted Donkey Kong / vintage video game champion Billy Mitchell over the world record for Donkey Kong.
Yes.
There's been a lot of action over the past few months. In August, Billy Mitchell beat the Donkey Kong high score with 1,062,800 points, 1,100 points more than the previous record score. Mitchell reportedly quit his Donkey Kong game, still in progress. Asked why, Mitchell said, "Some say I'm being cocky. Some saying being lazy. I say I'm being Billy Mitchell."
You know, can I?
I've got 1,062,000 points. I can just quit now.
I have a friend of mine who used to do that. That was one of his dick moves. Was God, what the hell game was it? It was I believe it was a sit down. It was an awesome game. Now that I think, but it was a game called T-Mech, and T-Mech was a great. It was an arcade game, and it was a competitive. Tank game. It was sort of like Battlezone, but imagine if you were...
Okay, I know what T-Mech is.
Yeah, it was updated. This was in the mid-90s, so it didn't have vector graphics or anything. But imagine if you were playing like a head-to-head Battlezone game. And it was great. And they had it at this place called the Nickelcade, which is in Salt Lake, which was freaking awesome, and which I now discover has gone out of business, which is sad because it was a full... And it wasn't like the, you know, because they get it like the Nickel Arcade here, which is basically it's like a theater with some, you know, some video games, and they're all kind of broken down and, you know, whatever. But the Nickel Arcade was like this vast, massive expanse of video games, often like brand new games, like games that had just been released. And I don't know how. The guy probably just couldn't make any money on it. I think he was trying to like... I think that was a loss leader for the restaurant, and I think that's probably why it imploded. But you would go there, and it would cost you, you know, whatever, like $3 or something to play, you know, however many, it was 60 games. So we would play T-Mech, and his whole dick move, which I just hated, which just drove me up the wall, but I made it a point to never say anything about it or to betray the fact that it irritated me, is that he would get up on points, and we would get within like 10 or 15 seconds of the end of the round, and he would get a final shot, and then he would kind of do this elaborate, kind of a yawn, and then he would just get up and walk away. You know, and it's like you're sitting over there in your console going, but I got it, crap, you know, and it's just one of those, you just like, you just prayed for the day that they found a tumor in your head so you could just beat him to death with an axe handle. You know, you're not going to be walking away from stuff, are you then, huh, friend? So I'm just saying, it's one of those things that can be very aggravating to you because it seems like poor sportsmanship in the sort of McEnroe sense of the word. But, you know, he's just being Billy Mitchell, Don.
Well, he probably should have kept playing because later that month, Steve Wiebe reclaimed the record.
Was he pwned?
With a score of 1,064,500 points and recorded his championship game on August 30th for submission to Twin Galaxies. But Twin Galaxies has now officially counted plastic surgeon Hank Chin as the beater of them both with 1,068,000 points and have named Chin the current record holder. The attempt took 2 hours and 45 minutes. He was the record holder when Mitchell reclaimed the title in August. Chin, Mitchell, and Wiebe are all scheduled to appear at a Kong-off score-off planned for March in New Jersey.
It's been a while since I've seen that documentary, and I don't remember, maybe they said this and I just missed it. Did they ever explain why Donkey Kong, as opposed to, you know, like insert other game here?
No, not specifically.
Sort of an arbitrary choice, and now it's become the brand, so they kind of have to do it.
I think now it's the thing because of those guys.
Yeah, they've established it as but, it's like hot dogs because they've established hot dogs as the thing you competitively eat.
But the Donkey Kong thing was simply because those two particular guys both happened
that was their game
to be fixated on it. Yeah.
Right. There was a guy I feel sorry for in this whole story is a guy named William Carlton, who's sort of a He's sort of an ulcer, and he's the Hydrox to the Oreo of King of Kong. And his whole thing is he's a missile command savant. We've had him on the show, and there's a documentary about him too called Game Over, which unfortunately like no one has seen because you mentioned it. And I think he actually predates the King of Kong guys, but it was just the King of Kong movie happened to be the one that people latched onto. But that is sort of a fascinating thing to me, the idea that you would just the hyper acuity at one. At one particular game and not a recent game at that.
I was crazy good at Centipede. And that was one of the things I read an interview with one of the developers of Centipede once who said that women tended to be much better at Centipede than men because
the total chick game.
Something to do with just
it's Tetris.
The way it operates. I mean, and the multitasking, that sort of thing. But I used to I used to play at Madame Wong's. They had one at Madame Wong's in Los Angeles during the punk days. And I was often the high score leader on the Madame Wong's Centipede. But I would actually lose track of time. I would go into some kind of a fugue state where I would just start playing this game. And honest to God, by the time when I finally got killed, I literally had no idea how much time had passed or how many points I had.
You're in a casino.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Well, women are really good. Here's the two, leaving aside Ms. Pac-Man, the chick games that come to mind are Centipede and Frogger. And if you think about it, they are both, and I don't say chick game disparagingly. I mean, it's, men and women have, their brains are wired differently to some degree. It is because Centipede and Frogger are, when you think about it, they are both stylistically and dynamically similar to Tetris in that it is an item falling or navigating downward in a somewhat, in a limited series of patterns, but through a shifting series of other objects that are arranged in various configurations where you have to make decisions, as opposed to Space Invaders, which is a more male game because it's very binary.
Yeah, it's very linear.
Left, right, left, the left and down. Left, down, right. But, Centipede, if you think about the way that the Centipede board is laid out, it's got the mushrooms which are there, not unlike the pre-built blocks in Tetris. And if you think about Frogger, if you were to picture yourself on the other side where the alligators are, you can almost view the frog as being like a falling block that is having to navigate through other blocks. They just happen to be shifting.
Yeah, and except you're going from the bottom to the top instead of top to bottom with
so
the other ones.
I think that's why those games, they sort of cluster together like that. I don't think I have anything, sadly, that I don't think I'm... I don't think there's anything in terms of like old school arcade games that I really excel at. That's the sad thing about it is, every guy's like, well, my game is whatever. I don't think my game was anything. I don't think I had a special skill, and I feel like less of a man because of that, because every guy had like the game that was like there, like if I was on Starcade with Wink Martindale, I would totally play. I guess I had Smash TV, that was my game, but it's like, but the thing is you had to have another player. That's a duo game.
I have a weird, almost savant-like ability at Mortal Kombat as well.
That's hot.
Is Mortal Kombat the one where you're the two guys?
Finish him!
And from the very first time I ever played it, and I played it with Patrick in an arcade at a movie theater, I think it was at Century Eastport, and I would just kick his ass every single time. And he would ask me how, and I said, I have no idea.
Right.
Because I literally didn't even know what the buttons did.
Oh, God, you're a button masher.
I was just pushing things and doing things. But the thing is,
you're the mailman Chris of the arcade game world.
Just that one particular game. And I finally killed Patrick one time we were playing it. And he kept, keep playing. I was like, okay. And then finally, it just came to this point where nothing was happening. And I said, what happened? He said, you won. You beat the game. And I said, but I don't even know how.
You rivered a flush.
It was crazy. And so Patrick found that very frustrating as well, because I guess at some point I realized that this must mean jump and this must mean kick. But, when I first started playing the game, I really didn't have any idea how to do combos or anything, but I just kept beating him.
All right. Well, I'm just going to – I mean, that's fine. Here's the
thing.
But
I'm terrible at most other games.
No, it's okay. I'm just saying, I'm okay with that. You know why? Because it didn't happen to me. I'm not the guy in the story. I'm not Patrick. So, I mean, it happened to Patrick, and that's – I can observe that objectively and just say, well, that's unfortunate for him, because that is terribly frustrating when you are – you are up against somebody like that who, even if they become skilled at it later in terms of knowing combinations, and I'm not like, it's not like I'm all that great in Mortal Kombat, but everybody's had that experience of like, they've figured out like Sonya's, like fireball finish or something. And then you're playing like your brother who just goes like wham and just hits the buttons with the flat of his hand. And then suddenly your spine is being pulled out and you're like, well, how the... God damn it, all right. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Are we still in the Geek Watch here?
Yeah, because we have our Apple Watch, Geek Watch story. which is item the second. Verizon Wireless made the long-awaited announcement Tuesday that it Is that today? Yes, it is.
Yes.
That will start selling a version of the iPhone 4 on February 10th, giving U.S. iPhone buyers a choice of carriers for the first time. Since its 2007 debut, Apple Incorporated's phone has been sold exclusively for AT&T's network in the U.S. Pre-orders will start February 3rd. The price will be $200 or $300 with a two-year contract, depending on the model, about the same as the iPhone through AT&T. Apple issued its press release at 11:11 a.m. on January 11th. 2011.
Of course.
As the Daily Show's John Oliver shouted, F yeah, repeatedly, tech reporters convened in New York's Lincoln Center to cover the event. So far, what they know is the Verizon iPhone can't do simultaneous voice and data, so internet surfing won't work during calls. The Verizon iPhone deal is multi-year and non-exclusive, meaning the Sprint may soon be able to have an iPhone as well. The only new feature is the personal hotspot, whatever that is.
No, it means that you can use it as a 3G a hotspot for up to five machines.
Okay.
So, like, if you're somewhere and you don't have access, you can use it as a portable, you know, it's like to tether it, basically.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And pricing is basically the same as AT&T. Yeah, and that's pretty much it. Steve Jobs was nowhere to be seen. Apple COO Tim Cook handled the event.
He
called it the start of something big.
Well, and, you know, the thing is, and as much as, you know, people always talk about the Steve Jobs, you know, the reality distortion field, that he can just say, hey, I want everybody to show up and be excited for a story that will contain no surprises at all, because everybody knows exactly what the reveal is going to be. And everybody went, okay. And they all went, like, following the hypnotoad. And they, which, again, it's a skill I admire. But everybody, the Verizon guy himself, I forget his name, but the Verizon CEO himself actually made some statement to the effect of, like, everybody knows exactly what I'm going to say right now. He said, you know, if you print something long enough, it'll happen. He's like, hey, we're going to be stocking the iPhone. Bam, done. And, like, that was it. There was nothing.
And everyone,
yeah. And Steve Jobs said, show up, act surprised. And they went, yes. And so they were there. Here's the brilliant thing about this, though, is that Steve Rebell, when he started Studio 54, they had the most genius thing where for the first couple weeks that Studio 54 was open, there was no one inside. And I don't mean like it was unpopular. I mean, like, literally they wouldn't allow people in. You would hear the music thumping and there would be a sign on the outside that said disco full. And there would be a bouncer standing outside with the velvet rope. And it would say disco full. And people would have to go in. He'd be like, I'm sorry, the disco is full. And they would just turn people away for 2 weeks. And then at the end of 2 weeks, they took the disco full sign off and people flooded in. The iPhone only being available at AT&T is the disco full sign of the iPhone world. Where that's the thing of people were like, I don't want to have to leave. It's so if I have to quit my contract and go to AT&T, it's going to be so I'd love to get the iPhone, but I have to get a brand new service. And then I have to buy it. And then I have to, you know, and then it's like I'm on a new contract. But that's still, it's going to be $500. And I'm going to forfeit all my minutes at Verizon. And plus, I just paid for the phone at Verizon. And I just got to the end of my, oh, my God, they sell it at Verizon. I can get it now. You know, and it's like, and they will stampede. And by the way, and I'm just saying this because these are what the National Enquirer would refer to as checkable facts. Everybody has made a lot of how, you know, that this is a desperation move because of the ascendancy of, let's just say, other phones. Mm. It is worth noting that the iPhone 4 has sold more than any Apple product in history. So it's not like it's some like a desperation play, like, oh, my God, I'm unable to sell anything.
No, this is them very slowly just attempting to basically take over.
Supply and demand. I mean, the more, and it's like, as Gene Simmons once said, you know, the more they want it, the more you pull back and don't give it to them, you know? And so, and then when you finally do, then they're just like, OMG, I'll pay anything. You know, so God bless them. It seemed like there was something else that was notable about this that I was going to say. No, it's gone. And I guess they have, I don't know if this is now official. Somebody was saying, who was it who blogged about this the other day? Somebody was sort of notable. It's like a Robert Crinsley type guy said that February 11th, they're saying now is going to be the date for the iPad 2. Huh. And I don't know that that's true, but I think it was somebody sort of note said it was going to be February 11th that was going to come out. So this is all true. Oh, somebody, we should say this now because this is in the Geek Watch. Somebody has a question about something we said earlier involving technology. Let's see. Sorry, I'm not trying to artificially delay this, but this is from somebody said, I barely knew her, asks, what was the app that Rick was talking about during Legion of News that translated pictures of Spanish words to English? And then below it, he just types Richie Bristol, with a bunch of exclamation marks. It doesn't translate Richie Bristol to human. That can't be done.
Oh.
It's called Word Lens, and I don't know if it's for other operating systems as well, or if it's just for the iPhone. That I don't know the answer to that. But it is called Word Lens. It's $4.99. You can get the version that does English to Spanish, or the version that does Spanish to English, under the theory, I guess, that you would really only need one of them, because presumably you already speak one of those languages.
Hmm, that makes sense.
Also, they want your money. So, but it's $4.99, and yeah, that is in the that's in the iPhone episode. You know what I haven't? Well, you don't have a Mac, so you and I can't really talk about this. But you know what I haven't tried is they unveiled that Mac App Store last week, which I have not used at all. I haven't even really gone there. So that's one of those things that I got to like.
It's just downloadable apps for your computer.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, it really is. And I'm not just saying this because it's an Apple thing. It really is. It really is sort of an interesting step forward, because it is the one of the first stages of the fulfillment of what Larry Ellison at Oracle has been talking about forever, which is there's no need to go to the store and buy your program on a disk in a box and drive home. So it is a store for applications for the Mac, you know, for a laptop or a desktop that looks and functions just like the iPhone App Store. And so they have removed the physical packaging from it altogether, and they have lowered the prices accordingly. And the other thing about it is, not unlike the App Store, and pretty soon everybody will do this, which is why you should care about it, that you can also, not unlike the App Store, you can buy things a la carte. So, for example, if you don't want to buy, like, the whole Office program, you just want, like, the spreadsheet thing, you can just buy the spreadsheet part of it, and it downloads to your computer, and then you're running it. So you don't have to go, you know, to Fry's and just stand in line like a dick, you know, and buy it. So.
Which is as it should be.
Exactly. All right. That's your Geek Watch for Tuesday right here in the Rick Emerson Radio program.
By Grafthar's hammer, by the sons of Warvan, I shall avenge you.
Next. Ooh, loneliness and cheeseburgers are a dangerous mix.
By the way, I should say that I see that they've updated the id Software has updated the Rage app on my phone, so I have to download whatever the update for that is. And it's like the update for that is freaking huge. The update is like 2 gigs or something. So I don't know what the game could possibly do that it didn't do already. It was already like blowing my mind with what I got for like $1. So
I have to do that thing. I have to figure out what kind of a cable I need or something so I can try and I can plug it into my giant TV so that I could play it.
Amazingly enough, Apple will sell you a cable for that, Don. I know that's hard to believe, but for probably no more than $5,000 or $6,000, you know, they'll go in. But yeah, if you go and you just say like, I want to run this into my TV, and they'll ask you probably what kind of TV or what kind of connection, and then they'll sell you a thing. They'll sell you a dongle that goes right into the thing and into the other thing, and then you're good to go. Because you know, because they got that thing where you can use your phone as like a remote control or something for your TV now too. So it's
because I do love that Rage game, but it is, you know, it is on my phone, so it's very tiny.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. So then when they unveil it for like your computer or something, you know, or
they want you to get it for the iPad.
For the iPad,
yeah.
Can I just tell you what I, you know, speaking of geek stuff, can I tell you what I used this weekend that I had not? I went to see my mom's in Kennewick over the weekend, and so she for Christmas her BF. I got to quit doing that because it's because of the lol thing earlier. And now I'm just using internet lingo out loud like a dickhead.
Yeah, but it's got to be awkward, though, to refer to your mom having a boyfriend.
Not really.
That's
weird. But for some people, I don't know. I mean,
my mother dated gentlemen, but it's like when a guy's in his 60s, the word boyfriend just
Well, what
seems
am I going to say,
awkward.
Though? I don't want to say gentleman caller because then it sounds like I'm trying to be. Then it sounds like I'm making a joke about it, is the thing. It's like, and I guess I am like linguistically, but it's like.
Her lover.
See, and that just makes it, that's just weird. If I say gentleman caller, though, then it almost sounds like, I don't know, then it sounds like I'm sort of smirking at it. I'm really not. Boyfriend, it's not awkward. It is weird to think of your mom having a boyfriend, like in the sense that, like, growing up, you don't visualize your parents having a boyfriend or a girlfriend.
Right.
But there's just no better term.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't think of anything, you know, so. It does make it sound like she's dating a surfer or something, though, you know.
Yeah.
But he got her a Kindle for Christmas, and I got to tell you, I had doubts about that thing. I hadn't really used one much because I was like, well, you know, if you got the iPad, what's the point? I guess I could still sort of see that where you're like, if you got the iPad, what the hell would you want a Kindle for? And I have to say the one thing about the Kindle. I will say about Steve Jobs, he's reprogrammed our brains because I had to be told not to just like tap the screen. Like I kept going like, it doesn't work. And she's like, it's not a touch. There's a button. And I was like, oh, a button. I see. Savage. And so I.
How quaint.
Christ. Laura was trying to use my MacBook the other day. And I swear to God, she was pressing the screen of my MacBook just like a lab rat. She was like jabbing the screen on my laptop. And I was like, baby, there's buttons right in front of you. You can see them. There's a keyboard. You got it. And she's like, oh. But I used a Kindle, and I have to say, it is a neat little device, and I'd never really spent much time with one. Susan Reynolds had one that I used for like 10 minutes at one point, but it's great. And you know what the thing about the thing is? There's like no glare on that screen whatsoever. And
not even outside in the sun. It's really an amazing whatever it is they use for the glass in that thing. It is awesome.
Yeah, that iPad basically just comes with a pre-installed glare app. That all it does is like show. All it does is reflect the sun in your eyes. The Kindle though, I actually took it out on the porch and sort of like angled it into the sun just to try to test it under extreme circumstances. And you get like some glare, but really no more glare than you would get off the if you read a book that has bleach white pages. It was really amazing. And I looked. I didn't want to ask her how much he probably spent on it, but I looked online and was like, it's like $120 or something. So, which the other great thing about that is if you step on it and crunch it, you're not going to kill yourself the way that you would if you did that to your iPad, where you just have to like, you would just go home and you would never leave the house again. So I don't know that I'll get one because I still am very much, I'm an analog guy. I like books, but I couldn't see the appeal of that over an iPad until I used one. I was impressed though. It was quite a handy little device, and I did see that over the holidays for the first time the e-books outsold physical books.
I do really love regular books, and also part of the thing is my main reading time every day is when I'm in the bathtub. So you know, not taking an expensive electronic device into the bathtub.
Right.
Although I did set up this whole elaborate system with a shirt on a hanger with a pocket so I could put my iPhone in the pocket of the shirt so I could listen to Bill Bryson while I was in the bathtub. But anyway.
That sounds like one step away from like the stick and the sponge.
But I do love the ease of being able to shop for the book online and just download it.
And it's there.
And it's more, in many cases, they're more affordable.
Yeah.
And then you've just got it. I do love that because I'm all about the instant gratification.
I shouldn't even get off. I have a whole different thing I was going to say, but
I mean, it's gotten to the point now with just downloading stuff onto the iPhone and things like that. The 2-day wait for things from Amazon now just seems so impossible.
Well, they're like overnighting the thing to your house, and it's just like you can't
believe I don't have this right now.
I get really, really angry if something isn't available to stream instantly on Netflix. Like I get really, really pissed off
too.
About it.
You know?
What the hell?
I went through that over New Year's weekend where there were a number of movies I wanted to watch on Netflix. I'm going to watch. Oh, it's not available.
Right.
Oh, what do you mean I have to get the disc?
I get the thing where it's like I get angry when a movie that is still in the theaters is not also available on DVD. You know, and even with the turnaround time, like the goddamn Social Network is already on DVD. You know, and it's like, but now it's like, you know, a movie will come out and like a week later, I'm like, well, when is it coming out on DVD? You know, and it's like you realize just what a big goddamn baby you have become. All right. Did we close the Geek Watch?
Yes.
Okay, we did. All right. Well, I should take this opportunity to say that. I was going to make this a Squire's Electra thing, but what I'll do is I will say this about EH vending. So somebody asked if we have announced the new snack. Here's the thing about that. I think we're going to take a day, and we're going to give this some thought. I think we're going to take a personal day in terms of the name that snack contest, because I can tell you that after like goddamn what's his name it came up with the, you identified the sounds of corn nuts being crunched. And then, like, yesterday...
Damn you, Rick Rutherford!
And I should now give the name of the winner. So yesterday, the winner was Aaron Owen. So, curse you, Aaron Owen. May a pox fall upon you forever. You are my sworn enemy.
Now, again, the clues were two varieties...
That was the first clue.
That was the first clue. And invented in the 1960s.
That was the second clue. And from that, Aaron Owen, who, again, is dead to me now, came up with Funyuns. Which is correct. And apparently other people, I think, did it too. But he was like, but again, before the show was even done, like 5 minutes later, Cheryl's like, yeah, somebody guessed Funyuns. So I don't know how we're going to, I don't know how we're going to do this, but it's just going to be, you know.
Here, give me this Funyuns.
We're going to have to figure out some different way. I will say that in the meantime, in between time, you want to know that this contest is brought to you, as is this show, by, in this case, EH Vending. And EH Vending, it is owned and operated by a guy named Joshua, who is a longtime listener. And he's been listening for, I think, now, this is 2011, right? So that's 13 years I've been here. So he's been listening to the show since the beginning, 13 years, going on 15. And you can contact EH Vending either by going online to ehvending.com. It's 360-816-1853. 360-816-1853. Or you can call James, who's a sales manager, 503-897-1853. A204. By the way, I should say that James's last name is Fella, and at no point am I going to make a joke about that. So just get that out of your head right now. It's not going to happen.
Do you think people just call him that? Fella?
Hey, Fella. Can
hey,
I?
Fella.
Yeah, probably.
I would.
Damn you.
That's great.
Oh, I just swore that I wasn't going to make a joke. And
I wasn't
sort of
making a joke. I'm just asking.
You're legitimately curious.
If you have a last name like that, I mean, it just lends itself to that.
Yeah, well.
How you doing, Fella?
Looking
good, Fella.
You could contact him. Don't call up him. Don't say that if you hadn't already planned on saying that. Don't do that because then you don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be the guy calling up and
no.
Do you fear him? Do you suppose you even hear that joke anymore, or do you just sort of like does part of your brain respond to it like an autonomic function and you don't even really notice it? Like
it's probably
breathing.
It's probably for me when I get Tony Orlando jokes. You just kind of go,
really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Who does that?
Every once in a while, I still get one, or someone will make some joke about taking grease out of their way.
The thing about Fella is at least that's like an uncommon sort of name. And I mean, in other words, it's not a joke you've had the opportunity to do before. Also, it's not from the 1950s.
Yeah.
That's just ridiculous. You should just ball punch the next person who does that.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind.
Tell him I said so.
By the
way, give him a little card.
These Funyuns are delicious.
Really? I've never had a Funyun.
Really?
You should save one. I can't eat it now, but you should save it for me.
I like them.
Well, in any event, so ehvending.com is the website for EH Vending, and Josh and James can take care of you. They provide all styles of vending service. And, of course, you think of, like, the traditional, like, you know, the candy machine or the soda machine or the pop machine, as they say here, to office, coffee supplies. You get the refrigerators. We've talked about the sort of branded fridges or maybe even that thing that's like a little automat where you put in the 50 cents and you open it and there's like a little, like a bagel roll or something inside. If you've got a business or if you've got an office or, you know, if you're just, you know, it's that thing where... And sometimes it's you. You can sort of blame it on your employees, though. But sometimes it's you, where it's like the guy leaves for lunch, and then it's like he comes back like an hour and a half later. You know, it's like, well, where I had to go to the plaid pantry, and then it's, you know, I had to stop for gas, and then I was, you know, and then I had to, you know, then I ran into Denise. You remember Denise? She used to work upstairs. You know, if you got the vending machine right there, then it's like if you yourself are hungry, your employees want a snack, they're not going to leave. It's like they got it right there in front of them.
Imagine if those little chocolate donuts were available anytime you wanted them.
That's fantastic. Can you imagine the addictive powers of such a device? You know, if you could just sort of press a button and just chocolate donuts would appear.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's awesome. And, you know, the thing is, I would imagine, well, I was going to say if you're the guy who owns the business, then you probably do that. Probably not, but at the same, you almost could, though, because presumably, like, you would just be able to, like, you know, you could just monopolize the donut row. You could just say, like, look, nobody presses B5 but me. That's it. Yeah, anybody else presses B5, you're out. Well... Whatever. So if you are the decision maker at a business and you want to maybe you know get the vending happening or you're unhappy with your current vending provider, contact them at ehvending.com or 503-897-8204. And I don't know, probably tomorrow we're going to try to figure out some different approach for the Name That Snot contest. But that day is not going to be today.
Name That Snot?
What?
You have this thing with it's Name That Snack contest.
Well, I,
and when you're going from snack into contest, it does sound like this. Yes, snack.
Snuck. Well, in any event, that'll recur tomorrow and so forth. EHVending.com is the website. That is EHVending.com.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Hey, here's this moment where I was. So it's like what? It's about 12 after here.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get to the interview with Mr. Jason Lung here in a second. But before we do that, so is there stuff we need to get to? I've sort of lost track of where we are in the news.
There is one story in particular that I wanted to.
Let's do that. So here's the order in which we're going to do things. We'll do the story. We're going to take just a brief break because I've got multiple people. I feel like I'm a prison guard or something. Like this is Papillon, where they're asking if they can please have an opportunity to use the bathroom.
Like so, it's some kind of field trip to the museum.
Seriously, I mean, you know, like you're Wayne Rogers, just you know, laying tar by the side of the road and asking if you can drink it up here, boss. So, all right, so we'll do the story. We'll take just a very, very small break. We'll come back with the interview with Jason Leung, who's the author of This All Encompassing Trip, and then we will we'll have a little thing after that, and we'll call it a day. Here's Don Taylor.
The funerals of last weekend's shooting victims are scheduled to begin in Tucson this Thursday, and if the Arizona State Legislature has its way, members of the Westboro Baptist Church won't be anywhere near them. The far-right-wing group is known for picketing funerals of military members and celebrities, and in a press release on Monday, Westboro promised to show up at the service for Christina Green, 9-year-old who was murdered in the attacks. Soon after, Arizona lawmakers began drawing up last-minute legislation to keep them away. We patterned legislation after Ohio Sessions law, which is constitutional, it's been upheld in court, said Arizona State Representative Kyrsten Sinema. I got permission from the Speaker and the Senate President to waive the rules. We're going to pass the bill Tuesday on the floor, and the governor is going to sign it Tuesday afternoon. While Westboro protests have been protected under free speech laws, Sinema said she hopes the measures will keep them at least 300 feet from mourners.
You know, I know that it's like a dick move to show up at the funeral of a girl who, you know, and it's just, I mean, it's just awful. But I mean, it's like I can't be the only one who is troubled by the idea that they are waiving the rules that they would normally have to follow to restrict someone's free speech.
Right.
They're going to get around the process that is due the Westboro Church as citizens of the United States of America and presumably citizens of the earth because you know, these because the rights are, of course, given to you by your creator. They are not just for Americans. They are for all people, even people that you don't like, even people that are repellent and awful. And I know that this is all like basic stuff, but it seems to bear repeating because, again, they're going to they're just going to waive that, you know, that process that they typically have where they follow their own goddamned rules and laws before they can just go stripping somebody of their ability to say something.
And it is, yeah, it is troubling. A much better plan, in my personal opinion, was one of on Monday, Westboro announced that they would pick at the funeral. And family members and friends of Christina Green stated that they plan to create angel action, and participants will wear 8-foot by 10-foot angel wings to shield mourners from picketers.
See, that at least is like, you know, where they're just diluting it down or they're shielding it, which is like the bikers or whatever did.
Right.
I mean, that, you know, whether that's good or bad, that's, you know, that's the difference to me is like, and somebody has said that, you know, say what you want, but I love Arizona, you know, for doing this. Here's the thing. It has nothing to do with these guys. I just don't like the idea of the government taking away anybody's right to say something, because that just seems like a bad trend to start. Same reason I don't like the death penalty. I don't like the idea that the government just starts killing people like willy-nilly, because you never know when I'm going to be the guy who's on the other. I wasn't even there. I was at the movies. Crap. And then I'm like strapped to that cross thing in Texas, you know?
Yeah, it is. It is an unfortunate precedent. I mean, it really, really is unfortunate. I do like the idea of the angel action wings. That was actually an idea that was created by Romain Patterson of Colorado when he saw the Westboro Baptist Church protesting Matthew Shepard's funeral in 1999.
Is this private property or is it public property? Because it can't be private property because they could be evicted. The church could just kick them out.
Right.
So they're not on the church's lawn or something. They're across the street.
I think they stand like out on the sidewalk
in the
street.
I mean, you know, that's everybody's taxes, pays for public property. That's why you call it public property.
But they've got something like they've got almost 5,000 people on Facebook who are supporting this whole angel wings thing and people sending money to help create them. And basically the woman from Tucson spoke to CNN and said, They want to surround the Westboro Baptist Church people with their giant angel wings in a nonviolent way to say that our community is united. We're a peaceful haven, she
says. Here's the thing.
You know, that's taking action. Your government stepping in and saying, you know, we don't like what these people have to say, so we're going to take away your right to
protest. Well, it's not even just that. It's that a large group of people don't agree with what a small group of people are saying. And so we are then going to skip ahead in line and ignore our own rules to take away the right of a small group of people because what they are saying annoys a large group of people. And it's just a it just seems like a bad idea. That sort of thing never ends up working out well. Now, that being said, it's like the whole thing of like drowning him out or deluding him, or Michael Moore had the Sodomobile show up where it was just like hot dudes making out in front of him. That's great. I think Sarah and Greg went to that weird, the sort of like weird counterpros where it was like, Jesus hates toast, you know, and just like a lot of bizarre stuff. Like, I'm all for that. That kind of stuff is great.
My personal feeling has always been that if you want to, you know, pass some sort of legislation, pass legislation that for one day people who come to the funeral legitimately can walk across the street and punch them in the face.
Yes. There you go. Which is like a one sort of a, like a Rochambeau kind of a day.
Right.
Somebody says you don't have the right to harass people. Here's the thing. They're not harassing people because if they were breaking a harassment law, you know that they'd be in jail every time. You know that every state, if there was the tiniest legal justification for just sticking those guys in the back of a squad car and putting them in a station house all weekend long, you know that they would do it. So they're obviously not breaking any harassment laws because there isn't a police department in the world, and certainly not in the United States that wouldn't look for any fudgeable rationale for sticking them in the back of a police car.
Right, because they are horrible,
yeah.
Just hateful, vile, probably mentally damaged people.
Yeah.
Just people who many of them must have like severe mental problems. But at the very least, you know that there's just so much damage going
broken.
On with these people.
I mean, well, there's the biography that Addicted to Hate, which is the biography of Fred Phelps that one of his sons wrote. And it actually was never published because there was a restraining order filed. Fred Phelps filed a preemptive lawsuit and they were restrained against publishing it. And it actually never came out, but I think it leaked onto the internet. And the stories he talks about being raised by Fred Phelps, I mean, are horrifying. I mean, like on a level that I could never have imagined. I mean, if half of it is true, which it probably is. But that's the unfortunate thing is you can tell they're not breaking the law. And the proof that they're not breaking the law is there's nobody we'd all like to see handcuffed and taken to a squad house. And, maybe they trip and fall 7 or 8 dozen times on the way there. So there you go. Well, there's that story. We'll do a real brief break here. We'll come back. We'll have our interview with Jason Leung, and then we will end things shortly after that. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Tomorrow, Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week will be here. And then coming up Friday, Big Jim Willig will have another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. This is the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Our next guest spent 197 days on the road following the sounds, the energy, and the community of Pearl Jam's 2005-2006 tour, and to whatever degree the intangible, indispensable magic of music can be put down on paper, he has done so. His book, This All-Encompassing Trip, Chasing Pearl Jam Around the World, is available now. You can find out more about it at thisallencompassingtrip.com. He'll also be signing the book this Friday the 14th at Easy Street Records in Seattle, a fine music emporium whose T-shirt, I swear to God, I am wearing right now through sheer and total freaky coincidence. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show, Mr. Jason Leung. Hello, sir. How are you today?
Pretty good. Pleasure to be here.
What was your first exposure to Pearl Jam, to their music, and when did you realize that it was something that kind of went beyond normal fandom?
The first exposure is kind of like where everyone saw them in the early 90s when they were all over MTV, one of the biggest bands in the world, and with like Nirvana and Alice in Chains and all those bands from that era. And they kind of just stuck around as opposed to dying off like most of the other bands. And that kind of stuck around with me. And that's kind of why they became one of my favorite bands. And when I started seeing them in live concerts, that's when I kind of saw what was so special about this music and how they interact with their fans.
That actually is where I wanted to go with this. Next, your book chronicles the 2005-2006 tour for Pearl Jam. Was there a specific moment when you said, like, I'm going to go experience this entire thing and I'm going to put it all down on paper? Did something in particular trigger the project?
Not really. I was kind of just putting it all down on paper and keeping track of things and documenting it for my own purpose, writing journals along the way. And after about 30 or 40 shows, I had about a volume of the diary. And I thought, this is something I can probably share with people because it was an experience that kind of changed my life a little bit. So I thought people would like to read about it. It's a good travel story. And I just wanted to do something with that, I guess.
You actually quit what I think my parents would probably still call a real job to follow Pearl Jam and to document the tour. Was it hard to make people understand why you were quitting your job, why you were going off on this, to do this other thing that was so different?
It was, because you grow up and you go do the normal patterns. You go to school, you get an education, and you get a job from that education afterwards. And I did all that, and I got a pretty decent job working as an engineer. And got a pretty good, decent salary, and the life was going pretty good. But there was no real excitement in my life there. So when I decided to do this, it kind of brought some new energy into my life, and I thought, this is something I can probably do for a little longer and see how that goes. But people weren't really understanding because of that. But you just have to kind of follow your dreams and go with it.
When people hear the phrase, you follow the band on this tour, their immediate frame of reference is probably the Grateful Dead, who are sort of the mold for that kind of a thing. From what you've seen or heard, is it tangibly distinct, in your opinion?
It's close. It's not the same, I don't think. But it's, I think the fans are a little bit closer even in the Pearl Jam community because the technology that we have now with social media and being able to keep in contact with everyone, I think we're a lot more closer. We know about each other more. Grateful Dead fans were just about going to the shows and then you leave afterwards, whereas we connect outside of the tour. So there's a lot of fans that I've met on the tour that I'll go visit from time to time, and they just become really good friends in general.
That is an interesting distinction, actually, because it's when people hear, when people hear the phrase following the band on tour, they wonder, what does that mean? And I, for the North American part of the tour anyway, it was basically you in a van going from one end of the continent to the other. How many miles and hours of driving are we talking about?
Oh, thousands and thousands of kilometers. I think we drove over 40,000 kilometers altogether at the end of the day. We drove a van from across Canada and then all around the U.S. And that was just a North American part of the tour.
I have to ask, is this just like endless months of eating everything out of cellophane bags from a truck stop?
to an extent, it was kind of like that. We slept in the van a lot of the times because it was the cheapest way to do it, and it was just the easiest because we weren't really booking things ahead. It was tough to be on the road. It's tough to get on any kind of place to plan where you want to stay and see where you're going to go. So you just kind of go with it and sleep in the van was probably the easiest way to do it.
I'm picturing, when I try to imagine this, and we're talking with Mr. Jason Leung, he's the author of this all-encompassing trip, Chasing Pearl Jam Around the World. I picture this as kind of it's almost like an Almost Famous meets Cash Cab, where you're kind of picking up other fans and dropping off other fans the whole tour through. Was that how it was planned, or did it just sort of work out that way, that you kind of daisy-chained from one show and one group of fans to another kind of throughout the whole tour?
Well, it was a trip that we wanted to do for ourselves, but we also wanted to keep it cheap. So the option was to offer rides to people. And it wasn't all planned out before, like I said before, but we just kind of had that option out there for other people if they wanted to join in. And we had maybe three or four people, and But as the tours went along, you kind of gained a little momentum. People start to recognize you, and they said, oh, you guys are the van guys. Well, we need to ride to this city. We need to ride to that city. So you kind of connect that way, and more people kind of jumped in afterwards. So you got a rotating cast of crew throughout the trip, so it kept it more interesting that way, I guess. But it was never planned that way.
That's exactly how your parents probably hope that you would be described, as the van guy. Yeah, our kid, he's the van guy. He doesn't bathe much at all. No, just he's in a van. There's a real different vibe at work with any band like this. I mean, if you're a Clay Aiken fan, you know, you buy the ticket, comes in the mail, it goes up on the fridge, and then you go to the show, you buy the T-shirt, and you go home. But when you're following Pearl Jam around or any band like this, do people you hear these stories of people who really don't know where their next ride or where their next ticket is coming from? And how close is that to the reality?
There's a lot of us that do it this way, and there are the casual Pearl Jam fans that go there and see one show, and then they go home and they're content. Whereas there's a lot of us that they're very adventurous, and I think it comes from the music and the lyrics that they put into the music, and it kind of influences us to open up our mind and do more of this, I guess. So the shows are great, and everyone knows it's great, so you want more of it. Do more of it.
When you look back at this, I mean, maybe I don't even know if this was a thing you tracked during the tour. It might have just been too weird or too hectic. How much does it cost you to follow Pearl Jam for this tour for this year?
I actually did keep track of that throughout the trip, writing it down in like a daily planner. The cost, and I think it worked out to be just about $110 on the road for everything all in. It could have been a lot more expensive, but it wasn't that bad.
And so I guess then the next question everybody has is, like, how is that possible unless you were just selling your organs, for medical experiments along the way?
Well, because I had a good job before, I had a lot of savings in the bank there. And instead of putting that in investment for, like, an apartment or something like that, I used that for traveling.
Did you ever have a moment where you're there and you're following the band around where you just look out the window as you're going across, like, Des Moines or something, and you say, like, I really ought to be putting this money in soybean futures or something?
I mean, yeah, definitely. There's moments like that. And then you realize that you're going to go see another show tomorrow and meet a whole group of new friends that will really influence your life in a whole different direction and really put a positive twist in your life, I guess. Then I said, oh, yeah, this is all worth it.
And I'm glad you said that. That is exactly the point that I wanted to ask about. Right now, there's somebody or many somebody saying, well, you know, it's just a band, it's just a concert or several concerts. To whatever extent you can, explain the energy, the certain intangible something that kept drawing you back and it draws a lot of people back to Pearl Jam over and over and over again.
The band, they interact with the fans very well. And when you go there, you kind of feel like it's a private show, and they're playing it just for you. And it's very, very emotional, the band puts into it, and you really get a sense of that. And, the music, you listen to it outside of a concert, and it already hits you really hard. When you go to the show and you see it live, it's just on a different level. There's a lot of bands that do this. But Pearl Jam, they play each show differently. They put a whole new set list. They take it almost like a different show at a time, so you feel it's like something special every single time. So if you miss a show, you kind of think that you're missing out. So that's kind of the drive behind going to all these shows with a lot of fans, I think.
We're talking to Jason Leung. He's the author of This All-Encompassing Trip, Chasing Pearl Jam Around the World. Again, you can find out more about it at thisallencompassingtrip.com. I think one of the reasons that bands stay on the road for so long and for so many years is that it's a bubble. It's a sort of separation from reality in this really glorious way. Was it hard to come back to a regular daily life when this was all said and done, or when any tour is done?
It is, because it's like any kind of travel, big trip that you do for traveling. When you come home, if you say you go away for a year, you come home and you've changed a lot, but everything around you hasn't changed. Your friends are still at the same place, and they're all kind of on the same level. But so you kind of feel a little bit outside of it, but you kind of have to adapt, and you have some dreams, and you got to follow them, and you just kind of have to deal with it, I guess.
When it came time to really put the book together, it was something that was done, almost A to Z, I think, in conjunction with other fans. How did that How did that come together? Is it just, you know, a Facebook posting or like a Craigslist ad that goes up? Is it like, hey, guy seeks other people to help put together Pearl Jam book. Please, please email.
Yeah, I mean, the community is so tight. You have a good network of people, and you get the word out there really easily. And there's a lot of people that will help out. Like, the book was really, it was about 10 fans that were helping me edit it. So there's a lot of it really done organically and with each other. And so the book was more of a collaborative effort. Yeah, to finish it off, I guess.
You know, and the community and I, you know, we have, you know, a lot of listeners. Our listener Jenny, who I know has contacted you, you know, asking for some input on this because it's a thing that I have seen through my friends and through people I know and secondhand. And it's fascinating. I will say that the connection between a lot of Pearl Jam fans seems to go beyond, you know, the shared love for the music. I'll put it this way. I love Motorhead, but there's a lot of Motorhead fans I wouldn't trust with my goldfish. So what in your opinion is the additional something that makes the Pearl Jam community what it is? What is the extra ingredient that takes it above and beyond everything?
I think everyone's just on the same level. They all understand each other. They welcome each other into their homes. it's really strange because you go on this trip and you don't know anybody. And at the end of it, you have thousands of friends that are really close to you and you can really trust because they trust strangers for some reason. Because it's funny because when you go to another place, a random place, you know a Pearl Jam fan is going to help you out. And it's just in your mind that's all going to work out that way. I think it's all because of the lyrics of the band. It's something that's influencing into these fans. And they take that to heart, I guess.
I guess as we sort of wrap this up, my and this is a big question, but if you had not discovered music, in this case, if you had not discovered Pearl Jam, how would you mentioned coming back from seeing these long tours and being a different person. How would you be a different person if you had not found their music?
I don't know. The music kind of, it's an art form that kind of opens you into different directions, and that's kind of took me in a different path, I guess. If I hadn't discovered music, I'd probably be staying in an office job where I was before and really just living the life like normal people. And that's all fine. But this put a new twist into my life and it made it more exciting.
You'd be in a small room with a guy running an electric drill right outside your window for
exactly.
No reason.
That could have been me.
The book is This All-Encompassing Trip, Chasing Pearl Jam Around the World. You can find out more about it at thisallencompassingtrip.com. And again, Seattle listeners should note that Jason Leung is going to be in Seattle at Easy Street Records, a fine store, this Friday, the 14th, doing the signing. So that is this Friday, January 14th, Easy Street Records in Seattle. Congratulations on a great book and on telling a great story, and best of continued success in art, life, and all things, my friend.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
But somehow
listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. You know, I just noticed this box is... Those goddamn Burger King cheesy fries things went everywhere.
Oh, indeed they did.
God damn it.
I hate me. All right.
Did it occur to you to maybe, like, dump everything out of the box and throw the cheesy fries away?
No, it seems like a lot of work.
Clean up after yourself?
No. No, this is... this way I can just complain about it.
That reminds me. Whatever happened to the pizza boxes you had hidden behind the refrigerator? Are they still there? Did you ever throw them away?
I can tell that you're short-timing it because you don't even have your headphones on. You're just sort of...
You're sitting 3 feet away from me. I can hear you.
Well, I suppose that's true. It's but then you don't hear the warm stentorian timbre of my voice. I'm sorry, the pizza boxes that I shoved behind the fridge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's just that there became so many of them that I could no longer ignore it. You know what I mean? It's like it was sort of like the razor blades that you put through the back of the medicine cabinet.
Did Laura eventually actually notice them?
No, but she would have because she was out of town, and I did what, you know, I think I mentioned this last week. I did what I usually do when she's out of town, where she'd been out of the driveway 5 minutes, and I was like on the phone to the pizza place, you know, just ordering the largest thing they had. And then, of course, it took me like 5 hours to go through the entire thing. And then I thought, well, I could go outside, but it's all cold out there. And so I just went to shove it back behind the fridge. And it was that horrible realization where I think it's like sort of like when like a day that you realize like your pants won't button or something with it. There was no space left. Like it just wouldn't go.
Honest to God, I had
what prompted this question, by the way?
Because it's one of those things I think every once in a while it'll remind me and I'll wonder because the
idea. You wish you had a cam on it at home just to see what it looks like?
Well, when you first did it, it was because Laura was coming home and you were cleaning up crazily.
It's a stopgap measure.
And you're like, I will just stick it back here for now.
Yeah, no.
And then, you know, when she's not here, I'll take them out and throw them away.
No.
And I had this feeling that they would just stay there, but I didn't realize that you would just go, hey, good idea. I'll keep putting more in there.
I viewed it. I sort of like said to myself, you know, well, I'm sort of, you know, it's good for the environment because now they're not, you know, we're not having to spend the energy to recycle them and they're not going into the trash. They're just filling this empty space that would otherwise just be a void, a vacuum, a darkness. But no. And then I just went to shove the pizza box back there. And they just wouldn't. And it was like, and then I just shoved harder because like I didn't bother to look. I didn't look back there at first. I just went like, well, I guess I'll just put these in their new home behind the fridge. And I just... And it wouldn't, and I let go, and it just, you know, it stayed stationary. And I thought, well, that's weird. And I just started shoving. And then, like, some voice in the back of my head went, jackass, look. And I just, and it was like, there was like 9 of them or something. It was just unbelievable. And I, you know, but then, and then it's just like, then it's like, how do you get 9 pizza boxes out of the house at once without the neighbors seeing or without somebody, you know, like our neighborhood gossip seeing it, you know, and just, you know, they know it, you know, because with anybody else, they think like, well, they must have been having a party for the big game. But of course, they know that's not true for me. So there's no way to hide the fact that you're just filth, you know, that you live in a hovel.
That reminds me, actually, because my problem that I still, I guess, still don't always think of things that happen to me as being show material.
Yes.
So tomorrow, when we come to the show, I should probably discuss how I had to explain to my Mormon book club on Friday the statement that I haven't finished building my ukulele because I can't get into my office because there's a mattress in there.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I'll make a note to myself.
Because, again, like the pizza boxes, Mormon. Things get shoved places they're not supposed to be. So there's a giant mattress in my office, which is why I haven't been able to finish building my ukulele.
Duly noted. All right. Before we wrap this up, we should thank Squires Electric for helping to make today's entertainment possible. You can contact them at 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. And that's the other thing is I knew, speaking of Squires Electric, I knew at some point I would have to have somebody come to the home, you know, unexpectedly, not like a paramedic, but it's like, you know, you got to get something repaired. Or God forbid, I live in fear of the landlord coming by.
Well, this wasn't actually, I thought, was this between the fridge and something or were you actually putting them behind the refrigerator?
Well, it started off just being beside.
Oh, see, there's supposed to be space back there.
Because it's hot.
Yeah.
Well, that was like, I realized that they wouldn't, yeah.
That was a bad, bad idea.
Well, to be fair, I think that wasn't a thing that I read. That area didn't get filled up because I think I had, you know,
okay.
Some. Well, this is like how I eventually learned that you have to clean the lint trap in the dryer, which I swear to God, I just learned last year. I am 37 years of age. It's a miracle I haven't just been flambéed by now. But, you know, but it's not even just that the fire hazard, because, again, I wasn't filling it behind the refrigerator. But you just live in fear of the landlord coming in and just going, like, what kind of pigs are you? Who am I? Get out, you know, or just raising the rent out of anger at the fact that I'm just such a slob.
Yeah, I had to have the guys come in to fix my water heater last week while I wasn't there. And so I, like, cleaned madly.
Right.
So that they wouldn't think that I was like a crazy hoarder.
Because they'll ferry word of you back to the hive, and everybody will know.
Yes.
And especially the landlord, who we like to pride ourselves on being, because it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a scummy neighborhood in some ways. But we try to be sort of like, look, we're upstanding people with, you know, we pay our rent on time. Nobody ever has to come to the cops never get called to our house. We're not having loud freewheeling parties to all hours of the night.
On the other hand, there were 20 pizza boxes jammed behind the refrigerator.
But that's the thing. The carefully constructed facade would crumble if you were to come in and just see again that I was just... Because it's like, guys, you asked, you know, if I would look behind there, and I was just, no, I was just shoving it back there until it was full. That's how guys will just, they will just mash down the, you know, the trash can in the kitchen, the garbage, until you cannot mash it any further. They will compact until there's no more compacting that can be done. And then, by the way, what guys will always do, the same thing, they'll shove the trash down for weeks, and then they'll finally go, I guess I can't compress this anymore. And they will grab the plastic handles, pull the trash, and then, of course, the bottom of the bag breaks, and it just goes all over the kitchen.
And then they're angry.
Yeah.
Because it's
God damn it. It's
the trash's fault.
Seriously, why are these bags made so flimsily? In any event, Squires Electric, 503-252-1609. If they come to your house, you really ought to tidy up. They're good. They're proper people. They're upstanding folks. 503-252-1609 or SquiresElectric.com. Free estimates. No job too small or too large. They're licensed, bonded, and insured electrical contractors, installers, and supervisors, and they help to make this program possible. All right, we should bring the curtain down on things. Join us tomorrow, and our guests will include Mr. Aaron Mesh of Willamette Week. This is all true. We want to thank our guests today, including Mr. Aaron Geek in the City Duran and Jason Leung, the author of this all-encompassing trip. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News episode, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milk Packing District in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, at the news desk. Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agle, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa, the Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. It is Tuesday, January 11th, 2011, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. Thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Desire, 'cause down with me, I'm taking you.